We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Robert Malley, co-author of the new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Palestine. Also on the program today, Trump's concept of an idea for a plan for an ACA fix is causing spasms for Republicans on the Hill. U.S. holds secret meetings with Russia as Rubio's peace plans are in chaos. James Comey, Letitia James, prosecution collapses. Judge tosses and voids all of Halligan's work.
Gosh, they can't even do their revenge tour right.
Democratic mutiny in the Senate as the anti-Schumer Gillibrand caucus forms. Trump administration to review refugees admitted under Biden. 200,000 refugees, supposedly unvetted. Less than one-third of those arrested in Charlotte by the Border Patrol were classified as Border Patrol as criminals. Also on the program today, the former chemical lobbyist Trump have appointed to the EPA approve a new set of forever chemical pesticides for use on your food. Maha. Kristi Noem ends temporary protected status for Myanmar immigrants. Pentagon investigating Senate Democratic lawmakers over their video encouraging the military personnel to uphold the Constitution. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. It is
Newsday Tuesday.
But in fact, we have a great guest on today, Robert Malley, co-author of new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, will be on the program. He was the former lead in the, he was the chief negotiator in the Iran nuclear deal and has served under three administrations working with Israel and Palestine negotiations. We'll be talking to him. And then we very well may have a special guest later in the program. But before we get there, we're just 2 days out from Thanksgiving, ladies and gentlemen. And for those of you who have got the Walmart Thanksgiving meal, which is cheaper than it was last year, but of course comes with about 75% of what you could get last year for that. Harry Emden has looked at some of these prices. Now, this is going to come as a shock to you because Donald Trump has been saying that gasoline is down. It's not. Year over year, it is higher. Amongst many other sundry things that we pay for. Harry Emden?
Take it away.
I mean, just your costs are up versus a year ago. Groceries, 85%. Utilities, 78%. Healthcare, 67%. Housing, 66%. Gasoline, 54%. Wait. The bottom line is this. Americans feel like prices are rising in each and every single part of their lives, rising ever climber, and they just don't feel like Kate Baldwin that they can catch a break.
The Treasury Secretary in new comments kind of dismissed the impact tariffs is having on inflation, also saying that prices are going to be coming down in weeks. Some other prices are going to be coming down in months. What do Americans think about that?
Yeah, they think he's full of it. That's exactly what they think. I mean, just take a look here. Tariffs raising prices right now. I'm going to come over Kate's side of the screen, 71%.
How dare you?
How dare I do that? 84% of Democrats, 74% of independents, and even a majority of Republicans. When you can get a majority of Republicans to agree with majority of Democrats, you know that the pain is being felt by the American public right now. The Treasury Secretary can try and tell the people something, but they can feel in their pocketbooks. They simply put, don't buy what he and this administration is selling them when it comes to tariffs.
You know, and Harry, one thing we've heard over and over again is the president and many of those around him blaming the Biden administration for where inflation is right now. Do people agree with that?
No. No, no, no. You know what? I want to quote Judge Judy, but I'm not going to. I'm merely going to try and say it's like they're trying to sell ice up at the North Pole when it comes to this. More responsible for the current economy. 62% of Americans say it's Donald Trump. Just 32% say it's Joe Biden. Look, Donald Trump did, in fact, inherit an economy from Joe Biden. But now we are nearly a year into the Donald Trump administration. If the Trump administration is trying to push the buck over there, the simply put, the American folks aren't buying it. They say at this point, it is Donald Trump's economy. And what is happening in terms of inflation is his responsibility.
That's what happens when you become president.
Who knew?
I like these segments, but I also, the reason that 85% or whatever, over 80% of people feel like groceries are more expensive is because groceries are more expensive. Like, the polling data is important to point out, and that was that devastating Fox poll that we'd gone through a little bit last week. But there's also the facts that back up what people are feeling. They're not just in the midst of a mass psychosis or Trump derangement syndrome. Newsweek aggregated this. Beef is up 14% from January when you look at September numbers. A coffee increase up 30% if you compare it to January to September 2025. Eggs have decreased because we were talking about at the time there was that the bird flu, right?
Yep.
But bread has decreased slightly, but poultry, chicken has increased by 5.1% over that time period. Bananas up 8%. Milk is up 2.6%. Like, the facts show that groceries are more expensive as well as people's perception of it, which I think is pretty important to point out if you're a news organization. But I do like Harry's flair for the dramatic, I will say.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the bottom line is Trump has not, there doesn't even seem to be an attempt to pitch Americans otherwise. I mean, he keeps repeating over and over again that there are billions of dollars that are coming in investments into the United States, or trillions, I think he's up to now. Nobody believes it because half the time they're citing trillions of dollars of investment or billions of dollars of investment that are larger than the GDP of the country that they're coming from. Like, literally, if they sold off everything in their country, they couldn't, they still wouldn't have the money to invest what he says they're investing there. You know who we don't see very much on TV anymore, it feels like, is Howard Lutnick.
I was going to say, Lutnick said, give me a year or two.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then it's going to blow your mind.
He is, he's taking a pause, and he's just basically sitting with his sons waiting for that judge to say the tariffs are illegal, and then they're just going to buy an island or two.
Down the yellow brick road.
As a reminder, Lutnick's sons bought up a bunch of, redeemable coupons is where in the event that tariffs are found to be illegal, the government is responsible for paying back all of that money to the entities from which they collected those tariffs. People weren't sure whether they were going to get that money back or they needed cash at the time. So they sold these on 30 cents on the dollar. And it was Lutnick's sons that bought a ton of them. And so they're just waiting for the tariffs to be found illegal. The government pays back that money. But since the Lutnick, Uday and Kusei, I think of their names, they own those redemptions, they'll get it. But
it's been since the Epstein thing that we haven't seen Lutnick. Remember?
Oh right.
But yeah. His sons are in business with the Trump kids. So,
there you go.
There you go. It all is in the same slimy pool.
Networking. Okay. You should try it.
In a moment, we're going to be talking to Robert Malley, author, a co-author, I should say, of a new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. First, a couple of words from our sponsors. Today's episode brought to you by HelloFresh. You've definitely heard us talking about HelloFresh and the delicious meals that I get from them. They're the number one meal kit in America. They make home cooking easy with chef-crafted recipes and fresh ingredients delivered straight to your door. Now, they're serving up even more to love. Check it out. They're bigger, they're healthier, and they're tastier. I did like a chicken and rice dish for Saul 2 weeks ago, and he ate it.
Wow. That's huge.
I mean, the thing is, it's healthy. It's fresh. There's not a huge amount of waste. The portion size, they're really sort of perfect. They really have nailed this. But the menu's really huge. And the beauty is, like, I don't have time to cook. So I can get, like, 15-minute recipes. I can get 20-minute recipes. I can get 30-minute recipes. I tend to go for the 15-minute. But and nevertheless, occasionally I'll do a 20, 25. Because I just don't have that much time. But I also feel bad that, like, you want to give your kid a home-cooked meal. And so this allows me to have the best of both worlds. I don't have to shop for this stuff. It comes, it's the packaging is mostly all recyclable. It is really an easy process, and they have now doubled its menu. You can choose from 100 options each week, including new seasonal dishes and recipes from around the world. Dig into bigger portions that keep everybody satisfied. Feel great with an even healthier menu. Choose from 15 high protein recipes each week with options like grass-fed ribeyes or lamb chops. HelloFresh now helps you eat greener with new veggie pack recipes that have two or more veggies per dish. You can get steak, seafood recipes delivered every week for no extra cost. And now with three times the seafood options.
Whoa.
The shrimp dishes, actually. We had a, it was like a Mexican style, I don't know what you call it, fajita style shrimp dish. Delicious. Savor a hearty seasonal fall recipes like figgy balsamic chicken or cranberry Dijon pork. Discover new seasonal produce each week, from leeks to broccolini to asparagus and more. Want to thank HelloFresh for supporting the Majority Report and making it easier for me to make a home-cooked meal. The best ways to cook just got better. Go to HelloFresh.com/Majority10FM now to get 10 free meals. That's what the FM comes from. And a free breakfast for life. One per box with active subscription. Free meals applied as discount on the first box. New subscribers only. Varies by plan. That's HelloFresh.com/Majority10FM. That's Majority10FM. All one word. Get 10 free meals plus a free breakfast for life. Check it out. You will not be disappointed. We'll put the links in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Also, sponsoring the program today, a product that I use everywhere. Like, from the bathroom in at work to my bathroom at home, twice, two different ways in my bathroom at work and at home. I've got the hand soap. We've got the toilet bombs. I don't, you know, what do you call them? Cleaners, like you drop them in there. But I have all sorts of cleaners from Blue Land. I've got I use the dishwashing tablets. I use the laundry tablets. And here's the deal. I want to get rid of plastic. I don't want to be like using all of this one-time plastic stuff. I don't want to be lugging these huge containers home for laundry detergent or for dishwashing liquid back from the supermarket. And Blue Land has made that incredibly easy. Let me see. I haven't been reading the copy at all. They got cleaning sprays. They got toilet bowl cleaner. They got dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets. Blue Land formulas are 100% microplastic free. They're made with certified clean ingredients, free from chlorine bleach, free from harsh chemicals that are safe for us to use around my kids, my cat, me. Yeah. I mean, it is the cleaning stuff is much safer than other stuff. But honestly, I don't go to the recycling. I don't drop my recycling down as much anymore because I don't have these huge containers. And incredibly reasonable. You get with the sprays, you get the everything cleaner. What do you call it?
What is it? All-purpose.
All-purpose cleaner, the window and the bathroom cleaner. They give you three bottles. They're color-coded. Then you get tablets that are also color-coded in the paper packaging. You drop them in, water, boom. And it's a couple of bucks. They got hand soap, which is getting festive upgrade with cozy scents like wintry pine, toasted vanilla, and winterberry. We get the no-scented one because
yes.
I'm very sensitive. The dishwasher tablets are awesome. They're proven to perform on baked-on, burnt-on stains. I use Blue Land laundry tablets and the toilet tablets, all of it. Great. To stock up on sustainable cleaning products for yourself or to give a beautiful, sustainable gift to your friends and family this holiday season, go to blueland.com/majority and save up to 30% during Blue Land's holiday sale. I may give this to Mila for Hanukkah.
That's a good idea.
She's living off campus. And this is savings for me, ultimately. Don't wait. That's only once. They only do this once a year. That's 30% off during Blue Land's holiday sale by going to blueland.com/majority. blueland.com/majority. 30% off. Also, lastly, last sponsor of the day, Aura Frames. It is a great, great gift. I gave one to my mom in the years before she passed away. She was able to see the kids, even when she was a little bit, you know, as she got closer, was a little bit out of it. But the right. kids, you know, she could hear the kids. Sometimes she would talk to the frame. It is just an amazing gift. I gave one to my girlfriend's parents, and they ended up buying like four more, and now they're giving them as gifts to all their kids.
That's amazing.
Aura Frames provides you unlimited free photos and videos. All you got to do is you download the Aura app. You connect to the frame. It's super easy to do. You can actually preload the videos or the photos onto the frame with never taking it out of the wrapping. And so when you send it to your parents, your uncles, your friends, your sisters, or your brothers, whoever it is, your cousins, you can send it to anybody. Mm-hmm. And it will become preloaded with photos on there. It also make a probably pretty good wedding gift. If you were close to the bride and groom,
True. Well,
you could stuff it full of pictures of them. That's actually a great gift. I hadn't even thought about that before. So you preload the photos before it ships. And you can keep adding at any time, anywhere. For a limited time right now, AuraFrames.com, you'll get $45 off of Aura's best-selling Carver Matte Frames, named number one by Wirecutter. Use promo code MAJORITY at checkout. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com, promo code MAJORITY. A-U-R-A, frames.com, promo code MAJORITY. This is an exclusive Black Friday Cyber Monday deal. It's the best of the year, so order now before it ends. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. We'll put the link to that in the podcast and YouTube description. Quick break. When we come back, Robert Malley, conflict resolution specialist, co-author of Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome to the program Robert Malley, conflict resolution specialist, co-author of Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine, co-written with Hussein Agha. I don't know if am I pronouncing that right?
That was good.
Okay. It's a rare win for me. Robert, thanks so much for joining us. I should just also say, just by way of introduction, you served in the Clinton administration, in the Obama administration, and the Biden administration on in dealing with not just Israel and Palestine questions, but you were also the lead negotiator on the Iranian nuke deal during the Obama years. Thank you for that. I'm sorry it didn't last. Yeah. But honestly, it was, I thought, one of Obama's best achievements. During his presidency. But let's move on to the book that you've written. Like, what what inspired you at this point to write? This is essentially a history of the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians, more or less starting with the Oslo Accords in 1993. But why now? Are we at the end of an epoch or what?
Well, I think thanks for having me, but I think as the title of the book suggests, we're not at the end of the epoch. We're back to the epoch that we've lived now for decades and decades, which is, I mean, at least since the peace process began in 1993, has been this pretense that we were moving toward a two-state solution. And under cover of that pretense, all we've seen is greater fragmentation of the Palestinian national movement, greater fragmentation of Palestinian territory, and a further distance from that vaunted two-state solution. And we wrote it for many reasons, partly because on October 7th and after October 7th, so many commentators were saying that as if this was a rupture in the relations between Israelis and Palestinians, whereas Palestinians' desires for revenge, for liberation, even at the expense of Israeli lives, is nothing new. And Israeli, the kind of violence that they've inflicted on Palestinians, which now I think a majority of experts call a genocide, not much new there either. And so what we're saying is history is not, we're not at a rupture. We're back where we've always been.
Well, I mean, starting with Oslo, I feel like is important in that way, right? In examining the devolution of, I would say, the two-state solution myth. But I mean, the talking about it as a basically something that's internationally imposed without really buy-in from particularly Palestinians on the ground is fairly, I mean, from your end, I would say novel. Like, we have academics who speak about it in this way, particularly the Israeli new historians, but we're not even seeing most Democrats speak about the two-state solution in this manner.
No, and I think, you know, I get it, you know, Democrat, and even the sort of some of the more progressive Democrats, they want to show that there's hope. They want to show that there's something out there that they're fighting for that is realistic. It's the most conveniently available outcome out there. And frankly, I would sign on to it if I thought it was realistic. At this point, I'm not sure it ever was realistic, but you look at the situation on the ground, every step, everything that is happening is moving us away from that two-state solution. And it's invoked as a slogan. We call it a gimmick. We call it a lie because it's used to sort of anesthetize people and say, yeah, don't worry, we're moving towards this outcome. Whereas in fact, as I say, everything on the ground is moving in the opposite direction. Even the recent plan for Gaza is now, you know, you have the Palestinians who are divided between the majority of refugees. Now you have a separate status for the Palestinian citizens of Israel, separate status for the Palestinians in East Jerusalem, separate status for the West Bankers, who themselves are fragmented, now divided from Gaza. Now Gaza's partitioned in two. How are you going to make a state out of all that?
Okay, so I want to go back to just sort of like some of the broader things before we go through the history. What have been the most enduring myths throughout this process? Obviously, the two-state solution is perhaps the largest. But what are the other enduring myths that were present both like in 93 and then have continued on through the attempts, I guess, at the peace process?
I mean, let's start with the biggest, maybe the second biggest one, which is the U.S. as a facilitator, mediator, moving the two parties in some kind of equitable way towards a fair solution. I mean, we could spend hours about the biases of U.S. policy, some of them very conscious, some of them subconscious. Again, and we talk about them in the book. I think Americans should have bought into a narrative, tends to be the Israeli narrative, and so saw any step that the Israelis took as a sign of progress and were pushing the Palestinians to recognize it as such. And any Palestinian demand was viewed as sort of a negation of a willingness for peace, which leads to the next myth, which is it's always the Palestinians' fault. And that started at Camp David, where I was present in 2000. And all along, that the Palestinians, you know the slogan, never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And the reason that they are now living in the horror that they're living is somehow their fault. And then the more recent myths, again, that I got to, which is that somehow all of this is just because what happened on October 7th is because of Hamas and the extremists on the Palestinian side, and that the Israeli reaction is just the handiwork of Netanyahu and his right-wing allies, whereas both October 7th and their response were viewed positively by a majority of their respective communities. So we go through all these myths. I would say sort of one of the ones that is most important for this audience is the role that the U.S. has played. And given the power the U.S. had and the leverage it had, the fact that we are where we are today tells us something about how it exercised that power and that leverage.
When was it in the course? I mean, you've worked for the Clinton administration. You worked for the Biden administration, the Obama administration. At what point were you... Did you realize this was a myth, or was it clear from the beginning? I mean, and how did you, how do you deal with that? I feel like it came out quite a bit during the Biden years, where, you know, just even I'm just thinking about the State Department guy who was accosting somebody selling on a food truck up Upper West Side, but. It's become, really apparent in many respects that it's been throughout all of these administrations. When did that become and how definitive was it for you at different stages?
That's a great question. And we don't have all that much time to give my whole biography. But I think in some sense, the book is also to a large extent, a self-criticism by me and by Hussein, because he was also involved in the quest for a two-state solution, advising the Palestinians. So we both were in it. I think, once you're in that world, and we could talk about it at length, you sort of you drink the Kool-Aid, and you believe your own slogans, you believe your own mythology. And that's why I don't think that it starts off as a lie. I think it starts as a self-delusion. Over time, it becomes a reflex. You say the same thing. We're working on this irreversible path to a two-state solution. Everything else you sweep under the carpet. I don't know when it sort of dawned on me. I think over the years, it seemed more and more apparent that this quest, it's not just that the quest was an illusion, is that it served as cover, as I said earlier, for policies that were working exactly in the opposite direction. I think the last time that there really seemed to be a chance was under Obama. Even then, I was quite cynical about the chances that we were going to reach a solution. I felt that Israelis and Palestinians were telling us what we wanted to hear, but they didn't really mean it, and we were not prepared to exert the kind of leverage, particularly on Israel, that it would have taken. And after that, I think it just became a complete farce. And when the Biden administration started talking about the two-state solution, which, by the way, they only did after October 7th, before then, President Biden himself had said the conditions are not ripe, then suddenly after October 7th, because they were scrambling for something and they needed to assuage a domestic public opinion that was getting inflamed, Arab public opinion, they suddenly decided they rediscovered the two-state solution. And that's when it really became sort of a gimmick that was used for purposes that had nothing to do with the objective purportedly pursued.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the Obama administration. One of the turning points may have been when Benjamin Netanyahu basically decided to throw all in with the Republican Party, I'd imagine, as well, where circumventing Obama and speaking directly to Congress, in part in response to the deal that you helped negotiate, the Iran deal as well. Like, do you see that really also as the death knell of even, liberal Zionism more broadly, too, but like the Democratic Party being able and that side of things being able to have that severance, I guess, between Netanyahu and the Democrats?
I'd love to be able to blame Netanyahu for all of this. I think if you go back to the Obama administration, I know President Obama had a lot of admiration for him. But he once told us in a meeting that those who believe that Israel is going to change course simply because it sees the light, because it's good for Israel to make peace with the Palestinians and give them a sovereign state, that's irrational. Israel's conduct is not irrational. If you don't pay a price for a policy that you're pursuing. And so the real issue was why the U.S. didn't exert more pressure, leverage.
Well, I was just going to say, it's fascinating that Obama would be so explicit about that realization and then just deliver all sorts of weapons to Israel, despite Netanyahu doing that. I want to get to why that's the case. What is that dynamic of that relationship? But let's go back to Oslo. What is from your perspective, the the greatest misunderstanding about what happened at Oslo, and we should say this is Yasser Arafat and I guess Rabin at that time. And what was the greatest misunderstanding as the way that people perceived what was happening during the Oslo Accords?
So, I mean, in some ways, people depicted the Oslo Accords as a peace accord, which it wasn't. And it was, you know, it was some kind of understanding between the Palestine Liberation Organization, led by Yasser Arafat, and the State of Israel, the Prime Minister Rabin. But it was based on a fundamental disconnect between what the two sides thought they were getting. Israel thought that it was getting security that would be provided to it by the Palestinian, what became known as the Palestinian Authority, that the Palestinians would sort of police their own. And the Israelis felt that their main conception was basically accepting that there would be some kind of Palestinian entity. They weren't prepared to call it a state. It would have some kind of self-governance. And that was the bargain that they saw. They had won the wars, and now they were giving the Palestinians something that they could at least call some autonomy, self-governance. The Palestinians felt that at Oslo they had made their huge concession, which is they were prepared to recognize Israel on the borders of 1967, 78% of mandatory Palestine. They were going to take only 22%, and they thought that was their concession, and now it was up to the Israelis to reciprocate by giving them a real state with meaningful borders, meaningful sovereignty, and some kind of reparation for the refugees. So both sides were looking at it from very different angles. The Israelis thought that they had made a big gesture by recognizing the Palestine Liberation Organization as a representative of the Palestinians and giving them some self-governance. And they thought that what they were going to get in exchange was full security with the Palestinians policing their own. And the Palestinians thought that, again, they had made their concession and now it was their turn to get something from the Israelis. And they never resolved that contradiction at its core, and that got played out time and time again, which is why they were negotiating. It was like parallel lines that never met.
Was that a function of, I mean, because I grew up, you know, the idea of 67 borders. That was the only thing you ever heard. You never heard 1948 borders.
Mm-hmm. Right?
You only heard 67 borders because ostensibly the Palestinians, who both at once were not a considered conventional wisdom considered not to have had a society that existed there, were also responsible for a war in 48 they sort of got it on both ends in terms of like of what was attributed or not attributed to them. And so everything was focused around 67, which in and of itself was considered a concession by the Palestinians, but never acknowledged by, it seems to me, almost the rest of the world on some level. And so they were when they were taking 22% of what was ultimately their mandate from 48, they're like, okay, we're making a big concession. How much is, I mean, because we understand, and right now we make all sorts of excuses we have for, it seems to me, for like a decade about Netanyahu's, he's being pulled from the right. He's the moderating force against the sort of like growing literally fascist elements of the Israeli society. There never seems to have been a notion of looking at Arafat as having similar political constraints, like that he, as if there was no domestic politics within Palestinians.
So you made, Sam, many, many really important points. First point I'd make, and I'll just mention an anecdote that happened at Camp David. President Clinton asked the Palestinian negotiator to show him a map. He said, you know, you've been here for several weeks already. I want to see, what do you mean by a Palestinian state? And the map that he was shown was a map of 67, where Israel had sovereignty over all of Israel, you know, of pre 67, and the Palestinians had full sovereignty over Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. And President Clinton erupted and said, "This is a joke. This is not a map. It's your maximalist position." And the Palestinian reaction was, "It's not our maximalist position. It is our position. We want two states, but we want two states based on the borders of 1967. We don't accept the legitimacy of the settlements." Now, over time, they even compromised on that, and they said they would accept territorial swaps. But again, that captures that disconnect between what the starting point is. Is it 67? The Israelis have won, and they're now giving something giving land to the Palestinians, or is it 1948 where the Israelis are giving back only a part of the land that the Palestinians believe is theirs? Again, that was never resolved. I remember you raised another question.
Go ahead.
Which now I'm forgetting what it was.
It was the domestic pressures
on Arafat.
So in our book, we describe Arafat as the most democratic of undemocratic leaders. Think of him as a leader who didn't have a territorial base, didn't have funds, had no friends. All the Arab world was hostile to him. His only basis of support was his domestic basis of support. That's the only thing he could count on. So it's true, you didn't have democratic elections until quite late. But to call that a system in which he could just decide, which is the way Americans and Westerners often look at it. Netanyahu, as you say, has his domestic politics. So, and not just Netanyahu, all his predecessors have to cater to their right wing. That's why settlements have to take place, construction has to take place, or he's going to lose touch with his electorate. Whereas Arafat, he's the autocrat. He could do whatever he wants. That's a misunderstanding that has plagued American foreign policy, not just on the Palestinian issue, but time and time again. Yes, Palestinians have their domestic politics, and a leader can't simply do whatever they want by virtue of the fact that the Americans have asked them to.
Well, that's the convenient framing, I think, from the Americans' perspective, if it's the way that they like to handle other, Arab countries in the region, dealing directly with a despot and none of the democracy that would have to go into it. How would you characterize in those meetings the Israeli reaction to the concept of Palestinian statehood? What are their major concerns about that? Is it the fact that it would necessitate a military from the Palestinians? Or is your understanding kind of the idea that it would foreclose further settlements, or could be both?
I think it's both, and it depends on who you're talking to. I think there's sort of a unanimity today, certainly, but I think it goes back quite some time on the Israeli side, that a sovereign Palestinian state that has control over its borders, over its foreign policy, and that has a military self-defense, the means of self-defense, that is anathema. It was anathema back in 2000. It's even more so today after October 7th and after the Second Intifada in 2000. So I think that at a basic level, Israelis would say, why would we? Again, we won the wars. We won wars that were waged by people who denied our right to to exist. And now we're going to give them a state where they could have guns and they could have tanks and they could attack us. Look at what they do to us without all of that. So I think that's a consensual position among Israelis. And then, of course, you have many Israelis for whom the attachment is not just to the land of 67, it's to all of Israel. And by the way, many Israelis would say, parts of the West Bank, like the city of Hebron, is much more sacred and important to them than Tel Aviv, which has no religious connection, certainly not compared to areas in the West Bank. So I think both of them are there. And I think from an Israeli perspective, many say, there never was a Palestinian state to begin with. They attacked us when we accepted the partition plan in 1948. Giving the land to them is just going to expose us to greater risk. What's the point?
That's the sort of central paradox, too. There was never a Palestinian people, yet they were cohesive enough to attack us. That to me seems a little paradoxical. And one other thing that I think sort of like infuses the book, and then I want to talk about, sort of where we might go from here. But this idea of like, Israel had needs, in this case, security, and Palestinians had wants.
Yes.
Will you just elaborate on that?
I mean, I can't put it better than you just did. I mean, I think we quote one of the U.S. negotiators at one point said that. He said, this is not a matter of competing rights. It's a matter of needs. And from their perspective, Israel has security needs. And again, it matters what perspective, what prism you adopt. And if the prism is Israel is isolated, it's weak, it's surrounded by Arab countries, again, it's going beyond what it should do because it won wars of aggression against it. So it has a need. It has a need of security, and that is a primary need. And that means that if Palestinian land has to be annexed to Israel, that's what's going to happen. If it means that Palestinians don't have the means of self-defense, that will happen too. Of course, Israel will have the means of self-defense. And I just was looking back to a quote by President Obama. Again, it shows that this is kind of bipartisan, in which he said, Israel, like every state, should have the right to self-defense and to be able to defend itself by itself. And he was saying that in the context of a speech that was arguing for the creation of a Palestinian state. But nowhere anyone has ever suggested an American side that the Palestinian state should have a right to self-defense, because that's not a Palestinian need. So there really is an internalization, which I understand, of the plight of the Jewish people and of the need for security. No such understanding in terms of the Palestinians, who've been victims of dispossession and liquidation and assassination attempts. So, and as we see, you know, what experts call a genocide, but the notion that they would need to defend themselves is sort of foreign to the repertoire.
Is it? And I do want to move on to the extent that there is ideas of where we go from here. But is that dynamic a function of? It seems there were just more constituencies of Israeli constituencies, sometimes represented, I think, by Americans, frankly, at least I'm talking material and almost emotional constituencies, as opposed to the Palestinian side, where there were, again, it was just Arafat, and we're not going to contemplate what the lived experience of Palestinians is. I mean, and I think so many Israelis seem to not have any awareness of what goes on just in even the West Bank, which is, you know, miles away. It's like, I don't know, it's not even, you know, Rhode Island is further away from where we are right now than the West Bank. But it is a world away. Is that, was that a sort of a deliberate construct in some way, like that the Israelis were, it was developed in such a way that Israelis did not have an awareness of what was going on there, that these concerns, these lived experiences did in no way sort of would get infused in these talks or the broader awareness?
I mean, certainly on the Israeli side, what you say is right. It's, as you say, it's also true of the American side. And I would say anyone who's watching this, just take a trip to the West Bank, visit Hebron for a day, and come back and tell us whether that your experience has not shaped your vision. It is just, you know, you can't come out of that trip and not view the whole conflict through a different lens. So, but you're touching on something that has so many different layers. Certainly, in terms of the Americans, there's a cultural affinity and a historical affinity to the Jewish people and to Israel, which is understandable, but doesn't exist at all when it comes to Arabs or Muslims in general. There's a strategic partnership with Israel. Israel is seen as a serious country with whom the U.S. can build an alliance. It's certainly not the case with Palestinians. Probably not even the case with Arabs, other than, as Emma, you said, that, you know, despots in power, but not at any deeper level. And then, of course, there's the domestic politics, which we could also spend a long time talking about, but which has weighed very heavily on the policy and on the perspective that American policymakers have on the conflict. So that explains, you know, blindness is sometimes sort of is witting, and sometimes it's unwitting. And here it was a little bit of both.
But the
one more thing. Like, where have been the other Arab countries? Because it seems like in the past, there was pressure exerted on talks on the United States, on Israel, by the reaction of the so-called Arab street, which is, you know, even in and of itself is a sort of a weird construction. You'd never hear like the American street or, you know, the Israeli street. It's what they're saying is the population. But there is that sort of like it's a weird construct. But
it's a connotation of a mob. Right. I mean,
yes. And
saying,
like, you know,
it's racist.
Yeah. It's racist.
Right. Yeah. Not to put too fine a point on it. Yeah.
But where have been the other Arab countries in this, because they seem to completely be hands off largely?
Because they've been complicit, because it served the leadership, it served their interest to pay lip service to the Palestinian cause, say that they're putting pressure on the Americans, have good relations with the U.S., military assistance, economic assistance, security assistance. And when things boiled on this quote unquote Arab street, then they might raise their voices, but not do that much. Now, in fairness, the power imbalance with Israel is such that there's not much that they could do anyway. But this has been a game that has suited almost everyone other than the people themselves. It suited U.S. foreign policy interests. It suited Israel. It suited the Arab states, as I just mentioned. It's even suited the Palestinian Authority, because it has been living on the largesse of foreign assistance, Western assistance, and it has sort of developed its own corrupt inner circle. So that's why it survived. It's been sustained for so long, because so many interests have converged and sort of finding benefit and profiting from the status quo.
But the overall interest that I just is it's just so frustrating to talk around is the idea that the land could be shared, the idea of one democratic state and what that could look like, and that is, in my view, really the most realistic option going forward when we see the hundreds of thousands of settlements that are already built up in the West Bank. We see, obviously, Gaza is segmented from the rest of Palestinian territory by design. But that appears to be maybe the non-starter for the Israelis. Is that your experience in your negotiations, and is there even a consideration on that front from the Israeli side or even the Palestinian side that we, you know, it would have to be imposed, I understand, but I'm curious if that even came up.
Never. No, it never came up. I mean, and even one could understand why. I mean, Israeli Jews would not countenance it at all. I think a number of Palestinians, in the name of self-determination, believe that they should have their own entity that they govern, and they fear that if it's one state, at least at the beginning, it would be dominated economically, socially, in every way by Israeli Jews. You asked me sort of when I came to the realization. I mean, I started off as a believer in the one state, binational state. I mean, that's much more consonant with our own moral and ethical view. And our, I mean, the theoretical American ethical and moral view. I don't think it's realistic today. I don't know what generations from now Israelis and Palestinians will do. But one of the core messages of our book is let's stop sort of bang our head and say two states, two states, two states, when there's no mechanism that's going to make it happen. You mentioned the settlements. There's so many other reasons. There has to be something. I mean, it could, unfortunately, the most likely outcome is the status quo only getting worse with more ethnic cleansing, more displacement of Palestinians, more land grabs. But there hopefully is some other way that is not two states, that may not be the one state as you just described it, but which allows both sides to govern themselves, to live, to coexist peacefully. I don't have that answer right now. And who knows how it will come. When it will come, it will require changes on the Palestinian side, on the Israeli side, and on one place where the change may be coming, which is on the American side.
Well, that's the one thing where I just, like, the two-state solution, I'm so in agreement with you on the sense of it being unrealistic, but there's also a more nefarious element to it, which is that it bides time for the exact ethnic cleansing that we're talking about here. So your book is so important in that it explains all of this, but I also just feel like the urgency is not necessarily reflected when people continue to talk about it in this manner.
No, absolutely. And it's hard to break from that habit. Like if you're a Western, if you're a leader, even an Arab leader, and you say, I'm going to move away from the two-state solution, it looks like you're moving away from anything that could happen. And so that's why I speak in private to officials who would agree with what you just said. Two-state solution is not going to happen. They don't want to admit it because if they admit it, it looks like they've given up all hope because they can't imagine something different. Now, that's laziness or an expediency. There has to be something else. And, you know, there have been many cases in history where the most unexpected occurs because people fight for it. But right now we're in this logjam where people think it's either ethnic cleansing, as we've seen, or two-state solution. And so the right-minded pick the two-state solution, even if they have no concept of how to get there.
You mentioned that there have to be changes in the U.S. and the Israelis and the Palestinians. The U.S., I get a sense of what that would be, and we actually may be headed towards that. I would imagine maybe Democrat. It's conceivable Republican Party, but more likely Democratic administration might finally say we're going to use some of our leverage, and who knows where the chips fall after that. But that would be a change. What would be the change in the Israeli side and what would be a change in the Palestinian side that would precipitate whatever, you know, which put a big question mark as to what the sort of like a relative equilibrium looks like. But what would be the changes?
So first, I think it's going to be hard to imagine a change on the Israeli side without a change on the American side for the reason that President Obama articulated, which is why would they? I mean, again, the status quo suits them. Just as a footnote, I think what's happening on the Republican side in some ways may be arguably more significant than on the Democratic side. We could come back to that. I think one change that has to occur is the Palestinians need, and people need to allow them to have a representative, legitimate, credible national movement. They don't have it, and that's partly their fault. But to a large extent, it's because outside interests have done everything to fragment the Palestinians, to prop up those Palestinians who looked and acted more like, you know, moderates, quote unquote, so they were more to our liking, but who have no legitimacy, no representativity, and therefore no credibility. So they're just there as actors who are maintaining the status quo, but they can't voice Palestinian demands, they can't represent the Palestinians, they can't have any active agency because right now they don't represent the people who they're supposed to represent. But part of that has been because of American and Western policy towards the Islamists. Part of it has been preventing elections or discouraging elections on the ground that those elections might yield the wrong result, fragmenting the Palestinians, and again, maintaining a leadership that does not have the capacity to do anything which suits many people quite well.
I'm curious about your thought about the changes in the Republican Party and how that being more significant.
So you mentioned on the Democratic side, and I'm very welcoming of what I'm hearing. My fear is that once, you know, you have a different leadership in Israel, once the war really ends in Gaza, then we might go back to business as usual. There'll be some voices who'll say no.
Air's let out of the tire, as it were.
Exactly. You know, oof, we dodged a bullet. So sort of the centrist Democrats who now are talking about withholding or conditioning aid to Israel will say, well, that was true when you had Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing allies. It's not true when you have somebody else. Whereas, in fact, again, as we describe in the book, there's nothing new. Israeli policy has been pretty consistent for decades. On the Republican side, what's interesting is that you have people for whom it is a core value, America first, and I don't agree with them on 100 things, but America first for some of them means the U.S. should not be giving this kind of money to any country, not Israel, not anyone else, and it should not be dragged into foreign conflicts by any country, not Israel, not anyone else. And it doesn't matter to them whether it's Netanyahu or Yair Lapid or Benny Gantz. That's not – so that seems to be pretty solid and pretty intrinsic to that America first school of thought. And, you know, for me, last week I was talking to the American conservative, this week to the Majority Report. I think that says something about how there may be a transpartisan view. We have to exclude all the anti-Semitism which exists on the right, but a transpartisan view which sees the relationship with Israel as having been abnormal and we need to normalize it.
I'm skeptical that that okay. movement's going to survive.
I'm sure you know this
after we attack Venezuela this weekend, we may revisit the idea of how deep that America
Fair
first.
Enough.
But I think at the very least, even if there is a sort of rump part in the Republican Party that is pushing in that direction, it may make it harder for the Democratic Party to sort of settle in a sort of comfortable zone of continuing on with this policy. I also think that there's the changes in the Democratic Party have been happening since, you know, Tim Kaine refused to go see Netanyahu speak to the Congress.
Yeah.
I think we have so much more to ask you, and so I hope that we can have you back relatively
anytime.
Soon. But hopefully, it's maybe with some element of optimism. Although it seems very, very difficult to imagine that right now. But it's a fascinating book, and I really appreciate your coming on, Robert Malley. The book is Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm and in our podcast and YouTube description. Thanks again so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks to the two of you. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. we're anticipating a special guest. But, you know, you know how it is with special guests. As soon as you call them special, they're
right.
Like, well, maybe we'll do it at that time, or maybe we'll do it a different time, right? I mean, we've all been there. Like, but let's. I know what we can do. Let's. I don't want to get into the Schumer
Dang
thing
it.
Because that'll take like.
We'll do it in the fun half.
We'll do that in the fun half.
The heat is on them when they do this.
however, yesterday during the show, news broke that both the Comey prosecution and the Letitia James prosecution, vengeance, that's what this was about. They were going to take revenge on Letitia James for bringing an action in New York State they were going to take revenge on Comey for, I guess, helping Donald Trump get elected. Was that
being a nerd?
Right.
Here is CNN's legal analyst on how humiliating of a loss this was for the Trump administration. Wow. Understand, they appointed Trump's like insurance lawyer to do the prosecutions because they couldn't find anybody else to do it. Apparently, not only did she lie about the indictment, she was not even appointed properly.
Your legal analyst, Ellie Honig. And Ellie, obviously, you heard Pam Bondi saying the Justice Department will be appealing this. Given what the judge said, though, I mean, what would that route look like? What are their options here?
So they do have the right to appeal up to the Fourth Circuit. But I don't like their odds, because if you look at this ruling, I will tell you, as a Justice Department alum, Caitlin, mm-hmm. it's painful. The way this broke, I was 10 minutes into teaching a class of college students in a class about DOJ and the need to be independent of politics. And so we stopped. We did breaking news is what happens if you take my class, put it up on the screen and started sort of reading the highlights. And at some point, I just turned to them and said, guys, if you become prosecutors, don't ever do any of this, because what this decision does is it calls out the two fundamental flaws with both of these prosecutions, the Comey and the Letitia James prosecutions. One, malice. The only reason Lindsay Halligan was there as the prosecutor in the first place is because the real prosecutors refused to charge it and got pushed out. And then second, on top of that, just incompetence, the inability to return a grand jury indictment and to follow the basic rules. So it's a dark day for the Justice Department. Sure, they can appeal, but I don't love their chances.
So you're saying if this was you, it would be pretty embarrassing, basically.
I mean, thankfully, I never had a case dismissed. Not that I was, believe me, I was far from perfect as a prosecutor. But to lose not just one, but two, your two biggest cases, again, on such a basic defect that you couldn't follow the basic law of just installing somebody who was technically qualified. And when I say qualified, I don't mean resume. I don't mean how good a lawyer. I just mean met the basic requirements of law. That's humiliating.
Yeah, I mean, Jane Rossi has been saying this basically every night when we've had him on, that this is going to be illegal, that she was not going to be able to stay in that role. But I think the question is, I've been talking to people at the White House and around the president. Maybe they'll refile Tish James. Do you think the Comey case is dead, though? Because to remind everyone, it was running up against the statute of limitations when they actually came and filed it. That's why there was so much pressure on Lindsay Halligan to do it, her second week on the job, first week on the job?
Right. So 4 days in on Comey.
You've heard the phrase, you don't want to put a hat on a hat when it comes to jokes. This was a hat on a hat when it comes to absolute legal failures. Halligan was not appointed properly.
Yep.
Because she was not appointed properly, every single thing she did, even if it had been done correctly, would be null and void. The statute of limitations ran out on Comey and Letitia James. But on top of that, everything Halligan did was completely botched. If you could say completely incompetent, or you could say completely nefarious. Because she lied about what the grand jury indictment was. She had there was numerous flaws in everything that she brought to it. Just be thankful that, to the extent that this is a fascist regime, they are not bringing their best. Like sometimes fascists come and they're a lot smarter,
more competent,
and competent. But there is something about having a total fraud as the leader of your organization. It's that other fraud, like competence is not.
Loyalty is what fascists like this, and not loyalty that goes both ways. Please, we see how Donald Trump, this is not bisexual loyalty here. Whatever. I went off the whistle sound. I thought we were having jokes here.
The bisexual whistle sound.
Yes. that it doesn't go both ways, because Trump throws people under the bus all the time. But it is amazing to see essentially that incompetence kind of come back to bite them, because he's relying on things like, you know, people having checkered past so he can hold it over them, just basic proximity to Donald Trump. And they have some competent fascists in there. Like Russ Vogt is unfortunately a competent fascist.
Yes.
But
not this day, no.
So you're saying if this was you, it would be pretty embarrassing, basically.
You got to follow that up with, no, it's good. I like it. All right, we're going to take a break, and if we get the guest, we get the guest. If we don't get the guest, we're going to come back and say goodbye and then go to the fun.
Yeah.
That's the way we're going to run this. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome back to the program the now Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani. Mr. Mayor-elect, thanks for joining us.
Very welcome. They tried very hard, the internet gods, to keep us off. They couldn't.
We have successfully, and yeah. That is, I know.
Let the people know we're calling in live.
Yes, yes.
We should say that you're in the middle of your transition team. I know you guys are raising money for that because apparently there's no city money for that. And it's showing in the context of the internet. And so hopefully we can get folks to come and contribute to that effort. But we don't have you for very much. So I want to jump right into it. There's obviously a little bit of controversy since you've been over the past week or so. You went to go visit Donald Trump. He's the president of the United States. There's also been, talk about you were asked about supporting Hakeem Jeffries this weekend. I'm really curious as to the it seems to me you have two constituencies. You have the citizens of New York City who elected you on four major material platforms. And then you also have movement people and who are looking for you to bring a politics that's associated with the DSA and progressive left of the Democratic Party. And, there's people who are in both parts of that Venn diagram. I think we are probably. How do you serve both those things? Or do you feel that there have to be concessions made on one side or another or both? I mean, how do you what trumps, forgive the pun?
I think what gives me hope, frankly, is that I don't actually see these as two distinct constituencies innately of themselves. I think at the heart of both New Yorkers at large and of the movement that I'm so proud to be a part of is a concern for the material. What does any decision actually mean for working people's ability to live a dignified life? And that, to me, has to be the framework through which I approach any decision or conversation. And, there's been a lot of questions I've been asked of who won in the conversation you had with President Trump. And it is all geared towards the sense that it has to be one politician or the other politician. And what I've said is, in fact, that it was New Yorkers who won, because it's New Yorkers that we actually spoke about. And I actually told the president directly that, we launched our campaign on October 23rd of last year, but there were far more people who actually heard about us after the president won election, where we went and interviewed New Yorkers in the hearts of the neighborhoods that swung towards him in New York City, right? Fordham Road in the Bronx, Hillside Avenue in Queens. And I spoke to the president how it was cost of living that brought those New Yorkers to his campaign and cheaper groceries, and how we sought to build a campaign looking to answer the question of how do we bring those voters back into a Democratic primary and back into the politics of our city. And we did so by listening to their concerns and looking to build a platform that spoke directly to them as opposed to have to be translated to them. And even in the conversation around, the question of primary challenges, and much of this I would say is typically private within DSA, but everything I've said has been reported publicly, so I might as well just speak about it to you directly. Is I went to the endorsement forum that was considering whether or not to endorse B in that primary challenge, and what I said there is that this is not a question of the ballot box of who you would rather vote for. This is a question of how you want to spend the next year. Do you want to spend the next year fulfilling the agenda at the heart of this movement, or do you want to spend it defending the caricatures of that movement? And the decision that I made and the one that I shared with other members that night as they were considering how to participate in that democratic process is to maximize every chance we have to fulfill the promises we made door after door, call after call, with many New Yorkers who had otherwise lost faith in politics years ago, so that we can tell them that success isn't just measured in the election we've already had, but also in our fulfillment of the agenda at the heart of that election.
I think that this...
And I was just going to say that I don't ever presume that everyone will come to the same conclusion as me. I don't think that dissent or critique is something that I'm above in sharing these decisions, but they do come from this as my framework, and I think it's honestly helpful to be able to share it with people.
No, I appreciate that, and I'm just eager to ask you these things because we have you for such a limited time, really. Is one, is it your kind of belief, basically, that delivering on your agenda in terms of the macro constituency that Sam was just speaking about is the best way to kind of show how the movement can expand and have more politicians like yourself across the country run in that way. And I would imagine that was motivating you and what you said to DSA. And two, does that mean that you're ruling out supporting primary challenges broadly throughout the city?
No, that I've made no sweeping decision on something at like a larger level as that. And to your first question, you know, I think often about what Bernie said at our rally, which was that what our opponents in the campaign feared the most was the power of example. And that example is not of just winning the election. That's the example of delivering a rent freeze, of fast and free buses, of universal childcare. Because those are things you can hold on to. Those are things that you can actually feel and see in your life. And so much of politics is this game of translation where a politician says something and then you have to jump through 10 hoops to understand how it relates to you, or if you're eligible, or if you hit the threshold. And these are not things that require that kind of a translation. These are things that are direct to our lives. And I think that it's, you know, I remember when I was running for assembly, a friend of mine, Kara McCurdy, who's an incredible photographer who works on our campaign, I gave her the palm card that we had just designed with Anish, who actually created the logo for this mayoral campaign. And I thought it was the best palm card we'd ever made. And she looked at it and she said, "What do these words mean?" And we were just using a language that speaks only to a very specific set of people. And I think it just comes back to that you need to speak directly to people, you need to speak about policies that are also direct to their lives, and it all needs to be without translation. And so to me, once we succeed in the fulfillment of any part of this agenda, it becomes an example of why New Yorkers made the right decision to believe that politics could be more than this, as opposed to that they were wrong to have hope again.
I don't want to put too much pressure on you, but I am quite convinced that your success in achieving these, you know, the four main planks that of affordability that you ran on, I think are really fundamental to the future of the movement. And so, you know, that's why my interest in where you feel like you have to make those decisions that are focused on delivering that material thing. About 6 months after you won the primary, we were talking that you have a limited window of peak leverage, not just because you're coming off of the win, but also because Albany is tied up in the governor's race, and the present governor has a candidate running to her left in some fashion, and that it might provide you with more leverage. I'm curious, and it ties into this fact that, like, it's nuts to me that there isn't transition funds, that because...
It's nuts to me too, brother.
I would imagine. I mean, it's honestly, this isn't, you know, with all due respect to my hometown, this isn't, you're not becoming mayor of Worcester, Massachusetts. This is a big city. And, but your need for transition to be running on day one, because what do you see as like your window of peak leverage to get what you need for the city?
I think New Yorkers are rightfully an impatient people, and I think what New Yorkers need to see is an urgency in how our administration is treating this work. And it actually all comes back to the transition. We want this transition to be a time where we can do the work of preparation so that January 1st is not the day where I'm asking myself, I wonder who's going to be my first deputy mayor,
right,
or I wonder who's going to be running my OMB, or, you know, I wish I had staff so that we could have done the vetting of the 70,000 applicants from our portal. And it means you have to ask people to invest in you in advance of your opportunity so that you can actually seize that opportunity when you're presented with it. And to me, I think that the first year is a critical time in how we start to both share our plans for the implementation of these policies, but also start to deliver for New Yorkers, because we often talk about President Trump in the context of disagreements that we have around policies or personnel. But one thing that I've often reflected on is that it seems as if the speed that Washington moves at right now is thought of as if it's exclusive to this specific presidency or this party or this ideology, when in fact it could be a marker for any kind of politics. And that's what New Yorkers also need to see. It's not, you know, I'm not going to announce, you know, on day one that we're going to establish a study or something. It's that we actually have to be doing the work of delivering and doing it in a way that New Yorkers can feel it in their lives, as opposed to something that they have to understand at an intellectual level. I can feel Amelia hovering over me, letting me know that I have to run away.
Okay. Really last question on this. Were you surprised when Trump joined you in calling on Con Edison to cut rates? Because for people that don't know, Con Ed's the electric gas utility monopoly in New York State. Do you feel that there are avenues to work with him on lowering Con Ed prices? Because my bill, everyone's bill in this office has been insane recently.
I am interested in exploring that further with the president. And when we were talking about what the cost of living crisis means for New Yorkers, when we got to the question of utilities, we were speaking about the fact that they only ever go up. They only ever increase on an annual basis. And, you know, I have been a participant in a rate case before where I've advocated against an increase and spoken about the fact that at that time, one in four of my constituent cases in Astoria had to do with Con Ed. One in four. And that is before they raised gas and electric by more than $60 a month. So I have hope. That's something that I want to explore. And I will always look to explore anything, frankly, that can address the cost of living crisis. And utilities are a big part of it.
All right. One last quick one. Okay. I got a 12-year-old son. Where are you on snow days? He wants me to ask.
Look, I have not even talked to the policy team, but I'll just tell you, I love them.
Where
I may have to clean this up later. We'll find out soon.
Where can people contribute to the transition if they want to?
Transition2025.com, and you can give whatever you're able to, just so long as you are a permanent resident of the United States of America.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Thanks, guys.
Amazing right, stuff. Folks. Mayor-elect, it feels good to say.
Yep.
And
you still feel like you have to knock on wood?
I do. I'm like, I can't even believe it.
We had some technical difficulties up front, obviously, so we lost a little bit of that time. They don't have an internet, a terribly good internet connection there.
I've literally live streamed from that building fine on my phone, so I don't know what they're doing.
That same building?
Yeah, that's where that.
But that happened last time before the election too. He came on. He just completely the internet.
He's in the same building as campaign.
You know what I think it is? It's the computer.
Yeah,
they may have. They use two separate ones.
In the future, I'm going to tell him to do it through the phone.
Yeah, that's a better idea.
Or just buy him a phone. He's just committed to leftist audio as a true left wing non sellout.
Right. Okay. I mean, he's following in the.
He's on the co-op.
The aesthetic. The aesthetic that we've established on this show.
Exactly. It just means he's a fan.
Leftist patina.
Exactly. Exactly.
I did not get that one, so.
Saul is going to really appreciate the snow day comment because he's...
Yeah.
He's invested.
There's one day, I think I was probably 2006... It was my birthday, December 5th, and I woke up, and it turned out that a pipe had frozen, and there was no school that day, and it was also my birthday, the greatest birthday I've ever had.
Wow.
It was awesome.
A pipe had
December
frozen?
December 6th.
Because it froze.
There it is.
Yeah.
Well, we have two birthdays coming up pretty soon here in the MR office.
It's
Sam,
true. It's very fast.
Is your birthday on Thanksgiving this year? No,
The day after. The day after. I had it on Thanksgiving last year.
Black Friday.
Exactly. That's right. The years are on sale, ladies and gentlemen. They get cheaper and cheaper every year. We will put transition2025.com in the podcast and YouTube notes. I would look. After Bloomberg left, I had friends who were architects who would do work for the city. And they told me that what Bloomberg did is spent a lot of his own money to just bypass all this stuff.
Yep.
And, And the challenges that are going to be facing Mamdani are going to be huge. They are going to come from, you know, it's not like Bill Ackman's like, well, okay. You know, you're going to see, Mamdani being fought from literally 360 degrees to prevent his agenda from succeeding, not just because of the implications, not just because Bill Ackman doesn't want to pay 2%, you know, marginal tax rate over his first $1 million. It is because of the implications of a successful mayoralty by a democratic socialist.
I mean, the CIA almost exists to stop this sort of thing from happening in other countries.
Yeah, and look, you know, this is why what happened with Trump was so impressive, because Hakeem Jeffries out there was, you know, telling everybody, I can't endorse Mamdani. I'm afraid because he's going to our midterm elections. We're going to lose the midterm elections because everybody's going to run against Mamdani.
Yeah.
And the framing was such that, you know, and eventually Jeffrey's like, I got to endorse him anyways. And that's my fate. But that was going to be the attitude. So you were going to have Democratic congresspeople running for office, challenging people or staying in office. And the worst of the worst of them, or even the mediocre of the mediocrest of them, were going to run against Mamdani too. They were going to try and get out ahead of that criticism that they anticipated from the Republicans. And now it is Donald Trump's words and video and just attitude can be weaponized against those Republicans as a shield. And so you're going to see, and they're going to be able to adopt the affordability planks. They're going to creep towards a populism, and it's going to be a creep because a lot of them don't want to go there, and a lot of them it's going to be disingenuous. But this is how ideas change. This is how mainstream, you know, conventional wisdom shifts. And the worst thing that can happen to that sort of very slow tide is for those who want to stop this tide to be able to point at New York and go, he's a failure.
Right.
And so this is really, really important that, A, if you can help resources for the transition, just from Brian having put on a bunch of productions knows this too, pre-production. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to have a good film or show or whatever it is, but you cannot have a good one without a solid pre-production. And then also it's, you know, it's important. And I appreciated what he said about Chiasse.
He was very upfront about that. Yeah.
Because, you know, it's clear he's making a calculation that the number one thing that he can do both for New Yorkers and for the movement, and he doesn't see necessarily a difference in those, is to deliver on those material things.
Your legal analyst, Ellie Honig. And Ellie, obviously.
Oh, and I also, so you were right about that. I just want to correct myself. I think, you know, we were all, there was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to AOC first coming out and then Zohran then later kind of, you know, saying that they were not going to be supportive of Chiasse. And
it leaking out, apparently.
Yeah. And then, well, then there was Zohran at the DSA meeting that he kind of touched on there, where he spoke his piece about why he want, you know, it seems to be the case that Jeffries basically said, I won't get in your way as long as you don't endorse a primary challenge against me. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Jeffries has to remain leader of the Democrats in the House. He could retain his seat. I think it's difficult, very difficult to dislodge him, though. But if there's a leadership change in the Senate, it makes those conversations easier. And then having that answer from Zohran right off the rip just about how he's not ruling out supporting other primary challenges, that's it. That's basically the answer there. AOC and Zohran stood down on Jeffries in particular, and then they're still saying game on, I think, for Dan Goldman's district and other districts across the city. That's pretty good. That's a pretty good outcome. And
I mean,
Jeff,
the art of war says you should open up. You should open up all fronts of war at all times. Just, you know, start every single battle possible. No, you have to prioritize which ones you want.
And, exactly.
You were being facetious.
I was being facetious
because I was like, wait a second, that's not what Sun Tzu says.
Sun Tzu says, empty the clip.
Right. Right. Don't even think about it. Just go,
turn
just
around,
go,
empty
just
the other
go
one.
Nuts. Yeah. That's what Sun Tzu said. No, so it's a bitter pill to swallow, especially because Jeffries has vulnerabilities, and if Zoran actually decided to go all in, I don't know if that contest would work out well for Hakeem Jeffries, but in terms of the time frame that we're talking about here, that limited 6 to 9 months or whatever that Zoran has to try to get a lot of this stuff done, that is also prior to this primary actually happening, and Jeffries would still be in office, and it could present some real challenges for him. So, and I would imagine Jeffries endorsing, even though it was at the last minute, was a bit of the final handshake on this. Is détente the right word for it?
I think, look, if I were Jeffries, I will tell you that this is what I would have said at that point. Once it became clear that, like, oh my God, people are calling for my head because I've been such an ass about this, I would have said, I'll make your life miserable, and not like I will ruin your mayor out.
I'm sure that's what he did. So,
and
yeah.
Hakeem Jeffries is the leader of the Democrats in the House. He assigns people committees. He has a lot of power within the context of the New York State politics. And the question just becomes, do you want that to be a roadblock to fulfilling the agenda, which is ultimately going to help the movement?
And one more point on that, too, is that you're seeing Zoran pick his battles very strategically prior to getting into office at the start of next year. That also includes Tish as the commissioner. He was basically, it seems to me, is making a calculation that I don't want to get embroiled in my first year with the NYPD and with the police union when I'm trying to deliver affordability to the rest of the city. And Tish, I know, has done some reforms, but if you were to like pick that battle on that front in this critical time, it would be very difficult. So he's chosen to basically strategically stand down on the Jeffries thing and on the NYPD.
Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. But today, I would go, if you are a U.S. citizen, to transition2025.com. Throw in a couple of bucks. We could have set up some. If we had the ability to, like, a coupon, like you get 1 month free for the Majority Report, your first month goes. But I wonder if that's even legal.
Right.
Never mind.
That sounds interesting.
I never even said a word about that.
Yep.
That sounds like I end up in jail with Dinesh D'Souza. Forget what I just said. If you want to go contribute to the transition, we'll put the link in the podcast and YouTube description. In the meantime, regardless.
I like when you work out your little schemes on air just without any forethought and then just tripped into something illegal.
Yeah, well,
improvisational scheming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Often his schemes are a way to funnel money out of Majority
Report. You're very successful at that.
My business powers are a little bit lacking, but nevertheless. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Hot Chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Send some coffee to the transition team. I'm sure they need it. Yeah, I don't think you can do that.
I saw that Zoran's a Red Bull fan, although that's not.
That stuff is very unhealthy for you.
I know. I mean, but
Tastes good.
I saw him on that Adam Friedland show.
Like he did.
Yeah, right. I was
it's the healthiest way to not sleep.
I will say, one of my good friends works for Red Bull, so I did. He spoke about that and like how it kept him going. And I'm like, there you go. This should be an ad for you. I know you can't use an ad for it, but like, how does this guy get all this energy? Red Bull.
Matt. Left Reckoning.
Yeah, for Left Reckoning Patreons at patreon.com/Left Reckoning, we had a Harvest Report featuring Kowalski from Nebraska talking about the year in trade war and how farmers have been eating it. And also Jackman Show. There's not going to be a Left Reckoning today. We're taking the week off because of Thanksgiving. So go check out the Jackman Show with Brendan James if you haven't. And also Robin Wansley, Independent Socialist in Minneapolis. They're forming a caucus up there, folks.
Mm. Folks, see you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone?
Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports.
We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
God. I'm going to go for that.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though. Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501. 1/2. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
We call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is the fun half. It is Tuesday, November 25th. It is going to be the last time. We are going to have a show on Friday. It won't be live, but it will be new. We have two things that we've served up. We got a great interview with Mo Tasek. She's a writer at The Prospect, and writing about how essentially in states where people have been dumped off of Medicaid, there are these vultures who come in and sign people up for Obamacare as a way of getting premium payments and put them into really crappy insurance. Gino, our Instagram maestro, is that his official title?
Yeah. Yes.
He maestro. Is interviewing one of the deputy mayors, right?
Yeah, Dean Fulheim.
To get some insight on what's going on with the Bomdani soon-to-be administration. Yeah, we'll take some calls today, right?
Yeah.
646-257-3920. Can't promise we're going to take too many of them, but we will. This story came out today. This is an interesting story.
Yes, very interesting.
It's so interesting that I sent it to myself like five times through the night. I woke up in the middle at like 2 a.m. I sent it to myself after having already sent it to myself at like 11:30 and 12:30. Pop this up on the screen. It is the New York Times reporting. Wait, what happened to my? Just bear with me, folks. Here, oh, here we go. New York Times reporting that there is a new caucus.
Fight Club is what they're calling themselves, which I love them. Love this group. It's probably the corniest name they could have come up with. Also, in the Fight Club, guys, they fight each other in the Fight Club.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right, but
and then they blow up a bunch of credit card buildings. At the end.
Spoiler alert! But I mean, if Bernie and Warren are in it, they might be down for that. But no, not really. But anyway, this is a good thing. Sorry to be a bitch.
The
about
first
it.
Rule. Yeah. Of Fight Club.
The senators included in the so-called Fight Club: Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, Tina Smith of Minnesota, Christopher Murphy of Connecticut, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. At least one of those, I believe, is running for president. That would be Chris Murphy. Chris Van Hollen, maybe. Maybe Van Hollen is looking to become the next leader.
He's my pick.
There's also a couple of others. Ed Markey, Jeff Merkley. Martin Heinrich of also participate in this group's actions. And basically what it is that they are pissed that Schumer and Gillibrand in the form of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee have entered in and are involving themselves in contested primaries. And these senators are like, let's let the primary voters determine who they want to be the contestants or who's to be the nominee. Now, I will say, like, I'm shocked about this because supposedly the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has not made any formal endorsements.
What?
But it has been widely reported that they have supported Haley Stevens, who's widely supported that they not only support Janet Mills in Maine, Haley Stevens in Michigan, Janet Mills in Maine, but they like pushed Janet Mills to jump into the race. And these guys are the senators and also Angie Craig,
In Minnesota.
And so these senators are like, what are you guys doing? And apparently, let me read from this. The dispute exploded in a private meeting with Mr. Schumer and Ms. Gillibrand last month when the skeptical senators raised concerns about the campaign arm's electoral strategy. They were livid after the New York senators denied showing any preference in the three states, according to three people familiar with the conversation. Now, you remember, like, we talked about how Heinrich made a point of going and, you know, trying to support, I think, Mallory
McMorrow. We know that, you know, the best candidate in that race is Abdul al-Sayed.
Bernie Sanders supported
yeah, Abdul al-Sayed as soon as he jumped in. But that was notable because Heinrich kind of has one foot in current leadership, one foot in this. Like, Heinrich is trying to position himself as a Democrat that's under 60 as like the future of Senate leadership in some capacity. And so he sees value in this as well. But Heinrich isn't just supportive of McMorrow. His group, I think it's a veterans fundraising group, donated to Plattner. So, like, Heinrich, I think, is a really interesting person to watch here, because all of the other names that we mentioned, those are probably, you know, our best senators that we could pick off the top of our head, and they're more left-leaning, and that makes total sense. And also have, like, a lot of experience and seniority in the Senate. Heinrich is somebody who is, I think, can go either direction, and it's interesting that he's named here.
And they are discussing the possibility of joint fundraising efforts. Now, understand, they're going
great.
To be fundraising against their own Democratic Senate campaign committee in a primary, lending their considerable donor list on behalf of candidates, offering endorsements, and making campaign appearances. Their first public move was a joint video offering a group endorsement of Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan of Minnesota, who is facing off Ms. Craig. And Ms. Craig is being supported by Gillibrand and Schumer. And the
lying to their faces is especially egregious in the case of Mills, because it's already been reported. I took a screenshot of it. It was like local Maine reporting here. WSHU. Mills will also get help from the Democratic Senate leaders who control the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, or DSCC. According to filings with the FEC, the DSCC and Mills campaign have created a joint fundraising committee.
No, we didn't. You're looking at the social media, and that's not true.
I mean, I'm not on TikTok, Chuck.
It's the tickety talks. We put out the tickety talks and the tickety talks.
It's not Kentucky Fried.
It's not a French fry. We put out the tickety talks, and we didn't do it. So proof is in the chicken.
Proof is in the FEC filings, Chuck.
Or the chicken.
What kind of bull is this?
Yes.
The one in Minnesota is, like, so egregious to me.
Well, she doesn't like Israel.
No, Jesus.
So
Peggy Flanagan has been Tim Walz's lieutenant governor
for quite a while. Lee's a weirdo.
She.
Tim Walz is a weirdo.
Oh, yes.
Tim Walz, no Josh Shapiro.
Yeah, right. Nope.
All right, I won't analyze it anymore.
No, go ahead, please.
Don't let me stop you. It's not even, this is not even just like Plattner being like a more Bernie style kind of coming out of nowhere type candidate. It's also they're putting their thumb on the scales with like just like really standard Democrats who have been
Janet
in office
Mills
for a while.
Janet Mills is a spring chicken.
Yes.
She's got a pep in her step.
She's aging in reverse?
Well, she's a firecracker.
Would be the oldest freshman senator ever sworn in. This is what...
Okay, well, the upside is, then I look younger.
That's true. She right? would be... She is currently older than you and would make
yes,
you look younger.
Yes, she's always going to be. That's the secret.
That's how it works. I learned that from Tiki Taki.
I saw that on a Tiki Taki and also an Instagram influencer. So... This is these senators acknowledging what I think is the reality that Chuck Schumer has done.
Hopefully.
You don't have half a dozen plus senators coming out and actively running against. And I'll tell you something. Not only is Chuck Schumer done. Now, it's just a question of when. Is it going to be 2 years? Is he? I suspect that they're thinking he's not going to be leader after 2026. And it's also interesting because if you've ever been involved in any type of situation like where the bosses change, if you are part of the old regime, you are in trouble.
Right.
Right. Like, you sold a script to HBO and the president gets fired. You're screwed because the next person comes in. They want a clean slate.
Mm-hmm.
Your regional manager switches out and all of a sudden all the other managers are in big trouble. Kristen Gillibrand, I think this is going to be a problem for her as well.
She's not up until 2030, and she is somebody who is in desperate need of a primary challenge. But yes, I would say, and too, I mean, she's been very intimately involved with like the Emily's List operation, which is basically a fund for corporate-friendly female candidates that has given us the likes of
Clinton feminism.
Yeah, Maggie Hassan and Patty Murray, I think. So, like, they're definitely the old guard here. But I do think watching Heinrich is interesting. And then there was this other part that I highlighted, too, about towards the end of the article when they looked at this kind of gang of the Fight Club looking at how they might replace Schumer. Much of the senator's efforts remains in the exploratory stage. At in-person meetings and on an active text thread, they are discussing the possibility of joining. Oh, right, you read that already. Then maybe there was another part where they talked about the possibility of who they're going to put up basically as their leader alternative. But they're not necessarily sure, I think. Van Hollen's being floated by these progressive groups. He's going to deny it until he thinks he has the votes to make an actual challenge.
And let me quote Josh Orton.
Oh, yes.
In the piece, a former Senate aide. He is he's called a Democratic strategist. He's actually the head of Demand Justice. And full disclosure, I am doing some voiceover, some ads they're doing. Just because I support what they do. And Josh is a former producer on this program back in the Air America days. But he is quoted as saying, I can think of no historical example that would compare to this level of internal caucus fear and dissension. To be essentially a guerrilla group of senators who are raising concerns not just about one bill or one decision, but questions of leadership's entire disposition toward politics and the Trump administration feels unique.
Yeah.
I think that is a problem. I mean, the Demand Justice, they are very upset about Senate Democrats who have voted for Trump justices, particularly some of the most egregious of these justices. They have gone out and done that. So
it's just like I can't.
It's interesting that we're reading about this.
Yes. And it's just amazing to me. And it doesn't say everything about Chuck Schumer's sliminess and Gillibrand's for that matter, that when confronted by their own caucus members. I thought Senate fealty was the only thing you cared about. And you're going to lie to the faces of your Democratic colleagues.
I was talking to the Baileys.
Talking a little bit about stretching the truth.
Okay, but when you stretch the truth, you've got to cover your tracks, not have FEC filings showing that you have a joint fundraising operation with the candidate you say you're not supporting.
Don't believe everything you see on the Tiki Talks. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has, I think, the largest aircraft carrier in the world. I'm not sure which the name of it escapes me. It's off the coast of Venezuela at the moment. You've heard the phrase gunboat diplomacy. I suspect that what we might also be seeing is just gunboat war. Right now,
Gerald Ford.
It's the Gerald Ford. I don't know if I would name anything.
So intimidating. Ford. Here comes the Gerald.
Here he comes, stumbling down.
It's built for tough.
He's going to come stumbling down to the
FBI plant.
Here he is. Never left it once.
The White House has designated Maduro as a member of a foreign terror organization.
A narco-terror organization.
Okay.
Maduro is, of course, the president of Venezuela. And apparently now Trump is going to be meeting with him. Play this clip.
I mean, I would love to see a change in government. My wife's from Nicaragua. We know how terribly the dictators there rely on Venezuelan oil. But at the same time, a lot of Americans don't want actual U.S. participation in regime change in Venezuela. They would much prefer the Venezuelans to do it on their own. Do you think the pressure that Maduro has received will force him to leave on his own?
Oh, I think Maduro is not Fidel Castro. Maduro is not a brave boy. So now that he has understood that he's on that very nefarious list of the terrorist organization, that the airspace above Venezuela has been closed off and the commercial airlines from the United States are not flying, he's understanding that we're about to go in. He understands that he has been our enemy for the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. Venezuela, for those Americans who do not understand why we need to go in.
Pause it for a second. What percentage of the American population do you think is aware that we have been at war with Maduro for 25 years? That Venezuela has been at war with us for 25 years?
It's war in a sense.
I think most of these people don't even know that Hugo Chavez is not the. Isn't it Chavez? And is he still there?
Let alone, like, personnel, they don't know where it is.
No. But we're at war for 25 years, and she's talking, and I think it's quite possible that we're going to, I don't know, bomb Venezuela, invade Venezuela.
Whew.
People are literally going to be like, what? We what? This is like when we went in, what was not the Falklands, that was when the British went in there.
Grenada.
But we've done so much regime change in our history. Has it ever been so poorly telegraphed or, like, you know, put on some sort of amplifier? They're supposed to do this stuff covertly, and yet every Republican's like, we're going to do it for regime change.
Well, the liberals shut down the School of America, so now we don't know how to do it privately.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like, he even in the question, he has, like, a sort of anti-war, like, you know, a lot of people don't have an appetite for this. She doesn't respond to that at all. She's like, no, we're going in.
We're going in. Keep going.
United States are not flying. He's understanding that we're about to go in. He understands that he has been our enemy for the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. Venezuela, for those Americans who do not understand why we need to go in, for
99.9% of Americans.
Venezuela, for the American oil companies, will be a field day. Because it will be more than $1 trillion in economic activity. American companies can go in and fix all the oil pipe, the whole oil rigs, and everything that has to do with the Venezuelan petroleum companies, or anything that has to do with oil and the derivatives. Number
two. Hey, say something about drugs. This is supposed to be about drugs.
Wait a second. Donald Trump, you'll remember, like, he famously said, like, Iraq was a complete waste, but we should have taken all the oil. Well, now we're doing it with Venezuela. And all those people who were like, I'm voting for Donald Trump because no war for oil.
I mean, no war, right?
No war, no war for oil. And literally, she is saying, Americans don't understand why Maduro's been our enemy for 25 years. It's because our oil companies can't get all of their oil.
And it's Maria Corina Machado is the U.S. ally, the one who just won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Disgraceful.
They gave it as the consolation prize to Trump because I guess he didn't meet their criteria quite yet, but soon enough. So they gave it to the Republicans and particularly Marco Rubio's pet new leader of Venezuela. With the failure of Guaido, they moved on to somebody even cruder, Maria Corina Machado, who also has openly talked about how it's important to privatize Venezuela's oil industry and that she wants the United States to come in. And she's been back and forth in the U.S. really for over two decades with, like, think tanks and being closely associated with Republican senators like Marco Rubio. So, like, I mean, there's no pretense anymore. They're being very explicit that this is about U.S. imposition and not about democracy, but at least they're being honest. Yeah.
It's very thin pretext, but the pretext is there that it's about drugs. And we had this clip, I don't know if we played this, of Andrew Schultz talking with Charlemagne here, and I just want to play this real quick here, but because the pretense, everyone who knows somebody or who purports to care about anybody who was lost to like opioids or fentanyl or whatever, know that that is being used as a giant joke to paper over this war push that it basically just wants, is Stephen Miller is pushing to get more power for the executive. But here's a Charlemagne, or Andrew Schultz.
And Schultz is manspreading like crazy here, so.
This is offensive.
Yeah.
It's just funny to me that like there are people that were happy Charlie Kirk got shot because they disagreed on opinions, and they're fighting for due process for people who are driving fentanyl into the fucking country. What the fuck do we live in?
But
why do we
that.
Have more humanity for people who are actually profiting off of killing Americans?
But you shouldn't be like those people. Don't become what you hate.
This is not about fentanyl.
My God, it's so ridiculous. And not only is it completely ill-informed and the spouting off stuff. Incidentally, we should say Democrats in the Senate tried to pass and bring up a bipartisan resolution. This was, I guess, like I want to say 3 weeks ago to vote on a war powers resolution. It did not pass. The House Democrats have also been trying to press for a vote on the War Powers Act to no avail. And so that's where we're at. We barely hear anything about it in the news.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. We've barely talked about it, you know, just mentioning biggest ship that we have is off the coast of Venezuela.
The Gerry Ford.
Yes.
And then it's like, oh, Trump is looking at talking to Maduro now. It's like after we've amassed a military buildup in the waters outside and like what stopped the air traffic around. Like America is a problem.
But isn't that Trump's style this whole time? Just maximalist and then come talk. He thinks he's punching people in the mouth. He thinks he's punching China in the mouth, and then they've completely decimated our soybean industry here domestically because they're not capitulating and buying at the rate that they would have, even close to it. It's a fraction because of the tariffs. Trump's arrogance and stupidity is indicative in how he thinks he's negotiating, which is he thinks he's punching people in the mouth and that they're coming around. So I guess we've killed enough innocent fishermen off the coast of Venezuela for him to finally think that he's able to meet with Maduro.
How many American soldiers and how many Venezuelans need to die to make the $1 trillion of economic activity or whatever she's pointing to? Like, oh yeah, what's the trade-off there? How many people want to die?
Kowalski
from Nebraska says Venezuelan oil is heavy and sour crude. The equipment to extract it is technically challenging and difficult to operate. The infrastructure alone would take 10 years to build. More than likely, this is a message to Latin America that teaming up with China or Russia will have consequences. Oil and drugs is a distraction from hegemonic control, of course.
That's our Middle East policy, too, by the way. We've moved from the more extractive phase of imperialism to a bloodthirsty defensiveness.
Sam says to Mill Ryan, don't you remember the lineal PSAs that is jokes Kennedy's third did in the 90s? He specifically thanked the people of Venezuela. Yes, Joe Kennedy had a program, and I think it was in the 90s, but I think it could have been in the early aughts, where it was actually during the Bush administration. There was assistance to people who needed home heating oil assistance was cut off by the Bush administration. And Joe Kennedy teamed up with Hugo Chavez to bring in oil from Venezuela to help, I think, with New Englanders oil needs if they were low income and couldn't afford home heating oil. That's from memory. Calling from a 630 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Is it me?
Yes, it's you. Who's this? Where are you calling
from? Hi, Sam.
Yes?
It's great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you. Your name is?
My name is Jonas.
Jonas from?
I'm from the Chicago area.
Jonas from the Chicago area. What is on your mind?
So to give you a little bit of background on me, which is relevant, I'm a homeschool student, and I'm a senior in high school, and I'm preparing for college.
Nice.
And I'm calling to ask you about Palestine.
Okay.
I, of course, since October 7th, I've seen all of the reporting and the social media posts and everything about what's going on in Palestine, and it's a genocide. I think that's pretty clear to everyone with eyes at this point. But I don't know the history. And I'm calling to ask you, and I guess the whole team really, if you have suggestions for, like, reading I could do, books, essays on this.
Oh, Jonas, you have come to the right place.
Yes.
You are.
Can I give a really a short one? And then, like, because I think the best one, like a really smaller book that can you can dip your toe in is 10 Myths About Israel by Ilan Pappe. That's a really like introductory book that I think is like lower barrier to entry. And then there's, of course,
did you
Rashid
see today's interview today?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I would also, yes, Rashid Khalidi's 100-Year War Against Palestine is really good. You could read stuff from Ilan Pappe. You know, what's also a good video you can watch on YouTube is The Great Book Robbery by Benny Bruner.
Mm.
That is worth watching for some history. And I would go back. We have interviews with, late Michael Brooks did a lot of interviews with Ilan Pappe and
Jeff Halper.
Jeff Halper. And
Jeff Halper's got a few. Yeah, Michael interviewed him.
And you can also, I interviewed Daniel Levy, who was also a negotiator, I believe, in the Oslo Accords, but from the Israeli side. I would search through our videos to find those. But 100-Year War, Palestine,
10 Myths About Israel by
Ilan Pappe and Jeff Halper.
What is the one you said, Emma? Sorry.
10 Myths About Israel by Ilan Pappe. But you can also read his other book that's now I need to, the longer one. The
He's got a bunch of them.
Palestine.
But the 10 Myths is the best, I would say, introduction for it. And
absolutely.
The best, if you want something, if you have an appetite for something longer, then the best intro is Rashid Khalidi's 100 Years War.
All right. Thank you so much. That's all I've got.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the call. Good luck. You know, Michael, when you watch Michael, Michael was also homeschooled.
Mm,
I know you guys are always, looking for fellow travelers.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Have a great day.
Right. Oh, also, check out the Goodreads Majority Report group.
Oh, awesome. I'll do that.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Well, I always love to hear from them. From the future.
Me
the
too.
Youth.
The youths.
Calling from a 901 area code. Who's there? Oh, my God. Wait a second. Really? I just saw that video. Okay, 901 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi. I think it's me.
It is you.
Oh, my goodness. This is the first time I've ever called in. I'm Scarlett. Hi.
Hi, Charlotte. Wait,
Scarlett?
Is the first time you called
Scarlett,
in you got on?
I did.
Wow, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. What's on your mind? Where are you calling from, Scarlett?
Yeah, well, today I am in Fayetteville, Arkansas, but I actually lived in Memphis, Tennessee for several years and have a lot of friends there. I've been pretty closely following the Memphis Task Force happening there right now. I wanted to shout out, first of all, I don't know if you've ever checked out MLK50 they're a small local news source there, and they're doing some really great reporting right now, especially on the task force. So just want to shout them out and definitely look them up. They're, okay. I think, some of the best reporting in the area right now.
Okay.
But yeah, I guess one thing I was, you know, I've been kind of reading the reports and the, I mean, of course, there's the usual bullshit of them, you know, having a lot of low level traffic stops and all that. But they keep harping on the recovery of missing children. And I don't know, I guess I'm curious if you know if anyone is just, because from what I understand, right, like when the news puts out stuff about missing children, you get this picture of like cute young kids, you know, being abducted by scary thugs. And when in reality, like, it sounds like a lot of these missing kids are teenagers who are running away from maybe a bad home situation or LGBTQ without a safe environment, or, you know, or they have a parent who's, you know,
abusive,
maybe legally not supposed to have them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess I'm curious if, I see that as a news point all the time, and I don't see anything really diving into, you know, the real story on that. So just curious if you know of anyone who's doing that work.
It's an interesting thought because, you know, we've spoken about this, I think, within the context of like the school board fights and the panic around trans kids, which is this, that there's a exploitative, there is a kind of parent that is more reactionary, controlling, and wants their child under their thumb, whether it's religion or sexual orientation or gender identity, that is anxious about a loss of control, or has a reaction, guys, has a reaction to the I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. What were we saying? Has a that is worried basically about their children being outside of their control. Sam just had to get up for a sec. And that might be a part of it too. What they're tapping into there.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Tennessee recently passed something to restrict health care for, you know, trans minors.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that
there's
dynamic
an anxiety.
Is in play there.
There's an anxiety that a certain kind of parent has that where they, not to psychoanalyze it too much, but that, and they tend to be, you know, religious fundamentalists, where the child is not allowed to be an individual or an extension of themselves. And so there's like a whole kind of, you know, political, the right-wing political operation that feeds into that anxiety, and, you know, maybe gives some sort of outsourcing of blame to immigrants for a failure of their personal lives.
Yeah. Well, and I just think too, like, if they're so concerned about kids and missing kids, maybe that, you know, all the money that's going toward the overcrowded jails and judicial systems in Memphis now because of the overbooking in the jail, like, that would be better spent, right? Like,
of course,
investing in food and education for kids and their families and, you know, just, yeah, basic needs of families. So it's really like you could do so much more with those resources if they were actually focused on that.
Absolutely. Sam, you're back?
Yes. Well, I mean, I listen, the all of this talk about protecting children by this administration is bullshit. They don't mm-hmm. care. I've got a story here, and we appreciate the call. We'll get to this, but thank you. Of ICE picking up a kid, an autistic kid, and holding him for 50 days, and nobody knew where he was. Do we have that clip? What is that? I mean, this is the idea that they're doing anything other than essentially trying to get rid of immigrants And they're just, I mean, that's where they're starting, right? Because now they're going after refugees in this country, perhaps the most vetted of all people in the country. They're going after green card holders. They're going after people who are here legally. They're immigrants, but they're here legally. They're not citizens, but they're here legally, and they're just deporting them because they're not citizens. They're, what is, I got this story here. There's a story here of, let's play this clip.
We begin with a reunion between mother and son more than a month in the making. The pair were reunited last night outside the federal detention center where the 15-year-old was being held. Fox 26's Andy Rodriguez breaks down what was said at the reunion.
This all started back in October when Emmanuel was reported missing by his mom after he disappeared in Spring Branch. We know Houston police retrieved the teen, calling ICE to see where he should be placed after HPD said Emmanuel Gonzalez Garcia claimed to be from another country. He was subsequently placed into the Office of Refugee Resettlement, where he's been for the past 48 days. That is, until last night.
This is 15-year-old Emmanuel Gonzalez Garcia telling Fox 26 how he felt bad about being held by ORR, constantly asking after phone calls to his mom, Maria, when he might be released.
Porque yo quiero.
Just 48 days ago, Emmanuel was reported missing, found by HPD, and transferred into ORR custody.
So public that believe in the mom, that a mom should be with her.
Friday night, he was released back to his family. Emmanuel's mother, Maria Garcia, says she couldn't believe it. She called her mother, her family, everyone she knew to let them know the news. But she also spoke out against Houston police, claiming she felt failed by the department, calling to other mothers in the community to not be afraid to speak up when it comes to their children.
We reached out to the Office of Refugee Resettlement to see if they had any statement in regard to Emmanuel's story. They said they don't comment on specific cases.
This is not an administration that cares about
protecting children
by yeah. any stretch of the imagination.
Almost like this is not the administration that cares about law and order as they break every law. You know, almost as if this administration is not the one that cares about, I mean, a lot of the things that they say. They'll just basically say that we're going to bring prices down. No, it's really about enriching the people at the very top. They will project and say exactly the opposite of what they're going to do in order to say anything to cover up the true intentions of the fascist regime.
Here is a perfect example. A British woman detained by ICE agents. She turned up at the ICE services offices in San Diego to finalize paperwork to secure her permanent residency. So she's here legally. She was put in cuffs, scroll down. She was stunned as she was taken away from her shocked American husband and newborn baby. She apparently had overstayed her visa, but insisted she was told by her immigration lawyers that this is commonly forgiven when filing for a spousal green card. And the fact is, it's not a crime. I'll just reiterate this from an immigration attorney. It is not a crime. Overstaying a visa does not disqualify you from a green card. So she was eligible for a green card. She was going in. She was literally going into the office and pulled her away from her 6-month-old baby. It's nuts.
Yeah, and the number one, accusation is a confession thing too, is about protecting children. I like, we have no idea. We will not know for years if there have, how many copycats in terms of these ICE Gestapo people have gone around the country and abused people and kids with masks on their face, because we have legalized the idea of this Gestapo going around without any identification in unmarked cars and stealing people off the streets, because they are a part of a class of people in this country that doesn't have full rights, and it's being exploited by this administration. Because like these fascists, they need a marginalized other to distract from what they're doing to the rest of the country. And they have picked immigrants here. And communities are standing up, but my God, like, especially I worry about these kids. We've seen many videos. There was that 15 or 14 or 16-year-old girl who was being manhandled by ICE like that. The people who operate in this way go after you if you're weakest, and they're predators. And so that's why they're going to be targeting kids increasingly, I would imagine.
20 to 30,000 kids staying home from school in Charlotte because they don't want to be terrorized by ICE. That's even kids that, you know, are come from documented families but are worried about being profiled.
Yep. Calling from a 603 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Sam. This is Joel from New Hampshire.
Joel,
another
from New
first-time
Hampshire.
Caller, long-time listener.
Joel from New Hampshire. What's on your mind, Joel?
I'm calling about a race here for the Senate with Chris Pappas, who is honestly one of the worst Democratic congressmen right now, and he does have a challenger. Karishma Manzoor is running against him. Similarly to Graham Platner, kind of a political outsider. She's been an activist in the past, but I've not seen this race get any national attention, even in left media, so I really wanted to put out the word, particularly about this guy. I mean, he's...
Is Pappas
when the
running
race started,
for the Senate there? No.
For the Senate, I'm sorry, oh. Yes. He's running for he was a congressman for 6 years. He's now running to replace Jeanne Shaheen. She endorsed him on the day he declared. There was this rollout, all these videos, like all the Midas Touch type people, Adam Mockler, et cetera. They all put out these videos with absolute boilerplate endorsements of this guy immediately before he had any challenger. And, you know, trying to run with, he'll be the first gay congressman from New Hampshire or whatever. It's very cynical ploy. And he is one of the worst, he has been one of the worst congressmen on Israel, which is a pretty high bar or low bar, depending how you look at it. He's voted to censure Rashida Tlaib, voted for the new anti-Semitism definitions, just you name it, anything AIPAC puts in front of him.
Wow.
And they gave him $500,000 before he declared. Now he's at 800,000, so they've given him 300,000 more since he declared, in a race that the media and Democratic establishment is basically treating as if it's uncontested. So it's just hugely cynical and kind of infuriating as a New Hampshire resident. So I really wanted to get the word out there, get people to know that, you know, it's a year away. The primary
is
in September.
How is Manzoor doing?
I don't know that there have been any polls released that I've seen.
You know,
she's
in terms
of gotten a little bit of local media attention. I have no idea. I would imagine not that high, because there just has not been much attention at all given to this.
Interesting.
So that's another reason I would like to put the word out there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's being right next to door to Maine, the contrast. And, you know, I can understand some of that. You know, Graham Platner is a unique candidate, and Susan Collins is pretty high profile. But
right.
And Janet Mills in a way as well. But this is just like, this guy's 44 years old. He's walking in to be a senator for 40 years, I'm sure. This is his intention. If not, you know, something. I mean, I don't think he has the charisma or whatever to be, you know, run for to be president or whatever. But I think he's looking at, you know, this is his jackpot.
We'll look into this. We'll look into this race and see what's going on there.
Thanks for the heads up.
Appreciate that. And thank you. Appreciate it.
Let's do a fun one, shall
like
we?
Bill
we
Maher.
Yes, please.
16. Go ahead.
I just even looking at this is just sort of shocking in so many different ways. I mean, first off, like, Lara Trump is just, I find shocking to look at just because of the enormous amount of plastic surgery that she's had done.
They all look the same. I mean,
and it's she's got that, like, they all go for the Mar-a-Lago face, and
which is just max filler, as much filler as possible.
It's so strange. I just find it so strange and disturbing to look at. But there's something about this set, having her on this set. Yes. Becomes even more disturbing.
Well, and just like the ultra glam, the, you know, red carpet makeup in the middle of what should be a child's bedroom, but is somehow Bill Maher's.
There's like a
weed den.
It's like it's lit like a strip club.
Yes,
that's what it is.
Yes, it's lit like a strip club, but it has the decor of a 12-year-old.
Yeah, it's very
probably
very...
what he told the interior decorator.
What's it?
Make it look like a strip club, but it's owned by a 12-year-old.
Go ahead, let's play this.
They're talking about some problems Bill Maher has with Trump, despite, you know, having had dinner at Mar-a-Lago.
Speaking truth to power.
I was going
to
say, as a liberal, a lot.
Oh my God!
I'm willing to sit down and talk to anybody.
Ask any conservative. Unfortunately, we can't ask Charlie Kirk, who was here.
That's right.
Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene was on Real Time, either here or on the show. Ask any of them. They will always, Ted Cruz, they will always say, we had a good time.
Yeah.
We had a good time. You know, now there are people who I wouldn't have here, like that little prick Nick Fuentes.
That is an unfortunate individual. And I hate that he gets associated so closely with... You know, the MAGA movement with my father-in-law, with all of this stuff, because that
they should denounce him more forcefully.
Well,
you know what? I think part of the reason why he's associated with it is because they palled around together.
They had dinner.
I mean, you know what?
You know what happens when you associate with somebody? You get associated with them.
They did it with Kanye
this past week. Kanye West called me to have dinner at Mar-a-Lago. Shortly thereafter, he unexpectedly showed up with three of his friends, who I knew nothing about. We had dinner on Tuesday evening with many members present on the back patio. The dinner was quick and uneventful. Then they left for the airport. Listen, if you are the former president or the president, and you are like 1 degree of separation from, not even 1 degree of separation, right? Like that's... There's no separation. If you're having dinner with somebody,
I didn't even know she was going to be there.
I had no idea. Absolutely no idea.
Who was there too?
I just ran into her.
What?
Oh yeah. Oh no. I know you didn't want me to be around her. But
why do people associate him with me?
Someone else brought her.
So strange.
You know, he didn't write that tweet because of the word "whom."
Right. Exactly.
And Cruz, I will always say we had a good time.
Yeah.
That's we had a good time. Important. You know, I have.
They're
you know,
good
there are
time, Charlie's.
Who I wouldn't have here, like that little prick Nick Fuentes.
That is an unfortunate individual. And yeah. I hate that he gets associated so closely with, you know, the MAGA movement, with my father-in-law, with all of this stuff, because that
they
is,
should denounce him more forcefully.
Well, I mean, maybe you're right, but he is certainly not
maybe.
Not the representative that I think any of us
in believe many ways,
should be.
I would
out
hope
front.
He... The problem, with your father-in-law is like, if anybody likes him, he has a real hard time not liking them.
That's true.
That I mean, and that has led him to some bad things.
That may
which,
be true.
Which... This is like, I mean, the idea that he's framing this as if Trump's heart is so big that if you're nice to him, he's just going to be nice back. It's a transactional relationship, you dumbass. Does he still have stars in his eyes because
no.
Trump was kind of nice to him behind the scenes? Also,
yes, that's going to come
I'm
up.
Sorry. If loving is too much, guilty.
Guilty. Okay. Fuentes is not.
I have an open heart.
Yeah.
And if someone meets me halfway, I meet them halfway with no judgment.
Unconditional.
No judgment.
Trump may have an opening in his heart, but that's beside the point. Like, Fuentes is now being normalized by the Heritage Foundation. They literally just put out a video to say that he is in the scope of acceptable debate now on the right. The Heritage Foundation is arguably the most important conservative organization in the entire country. The two most popular podcasters on the right are in the top 15, at the very least, or top 15 political podcasts in the country, top 3 or 4 or 5 right-wing podcasters. They're BFFs with Nick Fuentes. Tucker Carlson just had him on now. I mean, I guess they like put aside what they thought their differences were. Oh, I thought you were enough.
You're so
I thought you were enough.
Censorious.
But Candace Owens is open about this. Like this, it's not just we're so closely associated with it. It's weird. It's almost how the Democrats are trying to pretend like their voters don't like Zoran Mamdani. We're not associated with that part of the party. No, your voters like Nick Fuentes and they like Donald Trump. And there's a reason for that. So let's not like play this game here.
Yeah. Oh, somebody's reminding us of the video of Fuentes and Laura Loomer toasting to the hostile takeover of the Republican
Party. Ooh, let's
find
that.
All right,
let's... I guess we could watch a little bit more of these two geniuses.
You know what? I'm one of... I'm not the only liberal who said there's enough to attack him for. The thing about fine people on both sides, I mean, even Sam Harris, another liberal, has made the case I've made, like, it's not the full statement.
Of course it's...
Wait, so we went from him saying, standing up for a little, showing a little bit of backbone, saying he should denounce Nick Fuentes more forcefully, to then...
That takes a lot of backbone, Matt. You got to give him a lot of credit for that.
For him, I mean, look at the way he's in that chair.
He's saying, like, out and out, got to create a little more distance between you and the avowed, essentially, neo-Nazi.
And she's like, maybe he should... And then he, instead of saying, well, how about definitely? How about he definitely should?
Yeah.
He instead says, oh, yeah, it was unfair that everyone criticized him for saying there were good people who wanted to see the Robert E. Lee monument or whatever the fuck stay up at the Unite the Right rally.
Don't get him on that.
Oh, and I'll go all day on that.
I know, no. And what that is just this thing of him, anybody who likes me, I can't quite denounce, but this Fuentes prick, like Trump is not Hitler.
No.
I mean, Larry David said I had dinner with Hitler because
it was such
a bullshit thing.
Yeah.
Trump is not Hitler. This Fuentes kid, that's
Larry
Hitler.
David no, that's, that said your... I had dinner with Hitler. Actually, Larry David wrote a piece, a satirical piece about someone going having dinner with Hitler. And Bill Maher had cut a little close to it, but I don't like it when people make fun of me.
He's too old to kind of figure out, like, that he shouldn't be looking this butthurt on camera. He's now brought this Larry David thing up gratuitously many times.
There's that thing about, like, if nine people are eating dinner and then the Nazi sits down, then 10 people are having dinner. He's, like, literally, like, exhibiting that. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. You get what I'm... No.
Is it this picture of Laura Trump?
Yeah.
Because I keep losing my train of thought.
Lara.
There's nothing I will say that I've heard come out of his mouth that I think I agree with or many people who consider themselves MAGA. And quite frankly...
Okay, that's what I'm saying. Like, he said, I didn't have dinner with Hitler. I had dinner with a guy who had dinner with Hitler. And then I had dinner with him right after because he said Fuentes is Hitler.
Yeah.
That's it.
Hitler by the transitive property.
I can't find the Loomer thing you guys are talking about.
Don't worry about it. Let's play this a little
bit. Get back
bit more.
To puppet legs.
That the fact that he's got a Trump flag up behind him shouldn't say that, you know, we agree with him. That's unfortunate. We need to get you a new lighter.
What happened
around here? We got anybody with a lighter?
Someday somebody's going to explain.
Is this a sign?
He's so pissed.
So, like, yeah, it's just...
About
God,
Larry,
so
Larry
uncomfortable.
David.
He's now like down in well,
now that he remembered that Larry David was mad to him, he reflexively had to get high because his emotions were so hard.
I need a drink.
And the woman was talking for more than five words of the clip, so he needed to find.
Yeah, at what point did he go for the lighter?
Where's my fidget spinner?
Because I cut back to him here, and he's fidgeting with it. And she, I think you can see her like looking down at him, like playing with it.
I agree.
He doesn't give a shit what she has to say.
No, Lord.
I gotta be fair.
Give me 5 minutes
I gotta
and
be
I can
fair.
Listen.
I also don't really care what she has to say.
Well, she's not a guest on our
show.
She
wanted to be a senator, and I said no. Sorry.
But she does, if we're being fair, of all of the Trump descendants, she's the most competent, it appears, but that's also because she's not related to
him. By marriage.
She didn't get any of his DNA.
The best genes.
All right, one more call. Calling from a 615 area code. Who's this? You are the final caller of the day.
It's me?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Hello, this is Donald. I'm calling from Tennessee.
Donald from Tennessee.
So I live in the upper part of Tennessee near the Kentucky border-ish.
Okay.
It's called Sumner County out here. One fifth-place trans swimmer went to high school here, actually.
Riley Gaines?
Riley Gaines. I was very amused by the Pablo Torre thing the other day.
Yeah.
Because that's what she's getting up to out here. So
wait, what do you mean that's what she's getting up to?
What is she doing?
So she's been trying, or she was put on our library board to try and force through a trans book ban. So the same kind of, like, you know, going around doing whatever
Moms
or whoever.
Of Liberty stuff, right?
Yes, exactly, exactly. So our county commissioners have been trying to push through this trans book ban for probably since, like, Biden was still in office.
Uh-huh.
And it's kept failing because they keep voting against it. And so they tried to force, they forced Riley Gaines onto our library board in, like, a late night meeting a couple weeks ago to be, like, the final vote. And it failed again.
How did it fail? If she was, if, I mean, did they just not count the votes correctly?
They just, like, they thought she was going to put enough pressure. She's been using her platform a little bit to try and do some intimidation on, like, the other people on the library board. And they just still weren't able to turn out enough votes to get their book ban through.
Let me ask you this. Do you think if Riley Gaines had come in fourth place, that she'd have more pull, or if she had actually come in sixth place and was more aggrieved, would she have more pull? Like, which way would she have had to have performed better or performed slightly worse, come in fourth or sixth, for her to have more pull to cause the some book banning in your region?
Now, something about the fifth place, I think, really gives her her edge, you know, because if she had gotten fourth place, she probably, maybe she wouldn't have lost to a trans person.
Well, she would have tied.
And, you know, right? Maybe she wouldn't be so aggrieved.
She would have still gotten fifth if Leah Thomas didn't participate. She would have been just in fifth, yeah.
Not tied for fifth.
Not tied for fifth.
Right.
Well, you know, we're not swung by fifth place swimmers, I think. I think Sam is right. I think a fourth place swimmer might have gone to some people.
Yeah,
I think a sixth place finish, though, she could have felt more aggrieved. Like, I've been blocked out of the top five.
Right.
Instead of being out of the top five.
Well, because I think the top five, that was the issue, was that was when they were podiuming or whatever. That she had to share the podium with Leah Thomas. Is my recollection.
But now,
maybe we would have had a little pity, you know, out here. You know, one of our own was kept off of the podium by a trans person. That I can see how that would aggrieve some people.
I think there's some power to and be able to go, like, I came in fifth place. Like, you can put you can just thrust your hand out there.
It hits
you
your
can't
baby
say
brain.
Like, I came in sixth place. That doesn't have the same.
No.
But well, appreciate the update. Glad to hear that she's keeping busy. Now, does she, like, after she doesn't get that through, does she then quit the school board?
I believe she's still on the library board now.
Board.
It wouldn't shock me if they're trying to run it back again. It's a lot of the machinations of this fellow, Jeremy Mansfield, who's on our county commission. He has these dreams of grandeur. He's tried to use his platform before to, like, imply that his opponents are in the mafia. He's big on the whole rhino thing.
Sounds like there's a lot of weird shit going down out.
Tim Heidecker bit.
We also, our county is a targeted spot for some, like, Christian nationalist group who is trying to move out here, like a literal, like, cult group. So I guess keep Sumner County on your radar. It's Sumner, we're County. Right above Nashville, but but apparently not close enough to Nashville to get any of the those liberal values, which are still pretty weak in Nashville, but at least somewhat.
All right, appreciate the call.
Sumner County.
All right, folks, that ends the call-in portion of the program. And we'll read some IMs. Then we'll get out of here. Anonymous, I feel like Bill Maher is not an atheist. He has a religion. It's called Islamophobia. Every time Mamdani is mentioned around him, he goes into a fanatic episode about how he's a delusional socialist that'll run the rich out of the city and radical threat to Jews. That's always been, and that's also, that was Sam Harris's thing too. Like, I am against religion. Except for I'm really, really against Islam. And Sam Harris, people don't know this, when he was like, you know, he was a well-known meditation guy.
Yep.
And then he started branching off into sort of philosophical treatises about torture that he would also, you know, write in the peer-reviewed journal Huffington Post. And in defense of torture, I think. And then went on to talk about how religion bad. Islam is the mother load of bad ideas. And he would go on tour. And most of that tour was at brotherhood rooms in synagogues, which is an odd place for an atheist to go and have the most success. But it's, you know, the and now he sort of seems to have come at least somewhat full circle. He's out there. Somebody sent me a clip, I think, of him.
He's
on
a
some
Trump
show.
Critic. Yeah.
Oh, no, but of criticizing Joe Rogan now.
Oh.
He was on Trigonometry, and it was the most unbearable viewing experience I've ever seen. But, yeah, he's occasionally, like, you know, says vaccines are good.
Well, I mean, he's upset.
He's a Zionist, too. Like, that
well,
was a,
it's upset about well, we, Israel. Well, yes.
I mean, that was, in terms of, like, my, like, political awakening, like, my moving from being an atheist that liked Bill Maher and thought that was interesting to then hearing Sam Harris on his show and doing a bigger, deeper dive into that, like, changed my whole opinion about a lot of things, because you saw how he was using his atheism or selective atheism as a way to justify, like, deeply racist views about Muslim people yep. being inherently barbaric. I didn't have the language to understand that he was a Zionist at that point. But if people want to go back and check out some of those old, like the legendary one is when Ben Affleck yelled at him on Bill Maher, which is still very satisfying. And I watch that maybe a few times a year just to
we never got to
laugh.
It either. But he also acknowledged all the criticisms of Dave Rubin.
Oh, did we never get
no,
do that?
We had it on the sound sheet for like over a
yeah.
week.
He called me psychopathic
yeah.
in my critique of Dave Rubin. I think it was.
Yeah.
Psychopathic.
He owes you an apology.
He certainly does.
So you're saying if this was you, it would be pretty embarrassing, basically.
Kowalski has a shameless plug. I put out a video this morning on my YouTube channel, Prairie Fire, Nebraska, about the meatpacking closure in Lexington, Nebraska. I name names and call for Nebraskans to vote for Dan Osborne. Check that out. Avuncular Lefty, Samuel Malachi Bet David Cedar. You read my IM but about not all uncles, but you didn't read my screen name. To be fair, it is No Who's the Naboose. Avuncular Lefty, okay. Ostentatious Documentaries, Israelism, My Tree, Free to Watch on Tubi.
Also, Benny Bruner, who you mentioned, he puts like all of his on YouTube. So if you yep. just find him, you can watch yep. a bunch.
Great real estate. I am, in fact, brown and Mexican. My name is Juan and Jose. Thank you so much for covering heartbreaking stories. Much respect. Left is best.
Oh, did we say the whistles are up?
Oh, yeah.
I forgot. Sorry.
There, it's pre-order, right?
Yes.
All right. So we got some whistles. We got a pre-order. We're selling them at cost. $4. Oh, for a 2-pack. Okay, good. So there are $2 a pop. We're selling them at cost, and they come with a lanyard. We wanted to get orange ones because what I've read is like in folks where, well, we've got an adjustable button on that lanyard, and it's a reflective lanyard. That's great. These are premiums. And again, we're selling these at cost. And, you know, we had so many people reach out who wanted to donate printed ones. We're going to try and find resources where you could just contribute to them directly. Rapid response groups in your area or something like that. And we just, you know, it's something we're going to have to do after Thanksgiving. And my understanding is that, you know, the sort of the bright orange signifies to other people. They can be walking down the street and realize, like, there's other people there who are on team not fascist.
Right.
Vaughn from Wisconsin, no one should support any national level politician that does not actively denounce U.S. imperialism and the policies that support it and use the language explicitly. This is the only way to rationally engage with electoral politics in the imperial core. I mean, I don't think that's actually the only way to engage rationally. I'm not even sure that that is a rational way of engaging. To be honest with you, I mean, I don't disagree with the denunciation of U.S. imperialism and the policies that support it, but that's not the way that elections work. You can vote for none of the above, but that's not who's going to win. So I think, you know, we've been through this many, many times.
I mean, folks like this need to have show by doing, as opposed to say not like that. Like, it's as simple as that. And everyone is, especially now that, like, DSA, people are getting together and, like, actually doing things. Mm-hmm. Nobody has patience for it.
Whistler, there's an article from a while back entitled Anna, Lindsay Halligan here. It's a good look at Halligan's lack of professionalism as she complains to a reporter whom she knows very little that the Anna report Bauer. Is based in misreporting. Refuses to explain potentially compromises her case and then says day later, by the way, everything we talked about is off the record, obviously.
Yes. We've had Anna Bauer on who does great work covering these cases for Lawfare, I believe. And that was, I mean, I'm sure she just was like, this is my lucky day. She just spills everything and didn't say off the record. So there you go.
So you're saying if this was you, it would be pretty embarrassing. That's
such a fun question. You enjoy my socialism. I'm really disappointed that Zohran spoke at the Chi Forum and put his thumb on the scale. I wish he wouldn't play this charade as if he's just another rank-and-file member of DSA. He knows the influence he has. Ultimately, I think it's a false choice that we can either deliver on his agenda or run a difficult electoral races. I believe our capacity is exponential, not limited.
But DSA disagrees.
Well, not only did DSA disagree, but, I mean, you can't, on one hand, say that he has outsized influence. He may also have an outsized perspective on whether he can achieve his agenda in that way. I mean, he's clearly has an agenda, and that agenda is to fulfill his agenda as mayor. And you can trust him or not as to what his opinion as what he needs. But he only has one vote, and then also the influence that he has because of the perspective and the knowledge he has. I mean, that's what happens in the context of any type of, like, argument or vote. People are going to weigh that. So I think, you know,
DSA voted and they decided what they
wanted. And yeah, like, people thought it was relevant what he said for it. And if they voted the other direction, then, you know, they'd be supporting Chi, and they're not.
California resistance. Thanksgiving dinner. Mike from Bavaria, Zohran needs to be careful that leftist audio doesn't become libertarian audio. All right, five more of these. Indiana John. Oh, boy. My family in Indiana has just at least two prisons being used for ICE detention, the Clay County Justice Center in Brazil, Indiana, Miami Correctional Facility in Bunker Hill. Indiana Aid is a volunteer group that gets detainees resources they need and helps them contact their families so they know where they are. One organizer has described the conditions to me, and it's bleak. Many inmates are being given plastic sleds to sleep in and barely enough food to live unless they pay for more. Inmates typically only stay for a few days before they're relocated, seemingly at random. Most of the inmates are from Chicago, but they can come from anywhere in the country. So if you're not in Indiana, you may still be able to get help finding your loved ones. The site is indianaaid.org. indianaaid.org. We'll put that in the YouTube description. And if you're an immigrant in the U.S. and need legal assistance, go to immigrationlawhelp.org. Immigrationlawhelp.org. Luke from New Mexico. I've met Heinrich. He's pretty decent.
I think he's smart. It's interesting to see him kind of, yeah, position himself this way.
Bench Shapiro. Maybe Riley is mad because she spent all that time in the gym without seeing any gains. Oh, boy.
No, that's not, it's not weird and creepy. It's the gains, like muscle mass.
No, I knew.
Okay, the gym, right.
Well, it's not funny.
It was a pun.
Emma pun.
Did you think I didn't get that?
Yeah, I don't know anymore.
What was the creepy thing that
I just thought when you said, oh boy, that you were thought it was inappropriate. So
no,
just,
it was just bad.
Just move on.
What would be inappropriate?
I don't know.
The left wanted to make comedy illegal, you know.
Left Maxwell Lefterson. Have you guys seen North Star Radio's video North Star Radio's video against Graham Plattner? He argues that Plattner isn't truly anti-imperialist, but I don't see the point when the alternative is just a Republican or garden variety Lib Dem.
We are stuck in the realm of pure ideas, apparently. And it would be nice to, you know, maybe see the limitations of that faffing about.
So the argument is that a candidate running for senator is not truly anti-imperialist. I would say electoral politics is not the thing that you should be interested in.
Yep. Any thumbtacks I can stick in my neck? Or?
And the final I am.
Again, not like that. Left.
Of the day. We need to add high-speed train of thought rail to the next Green New Deal attempt on behalf of the MR crew. Not sure I fully understand it, but I definitely appreciate the sentiment. Matt, Brian, Emma, great job today. Folks, see you.
You won't. I'll be in tomorrow.
Well, folks, you will see these guys tomorrow, and we will have a new material for you on Friday. I'll be back live on Monday. Bye-bye. Happy Thanksgiving.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.